If you don't listen to talk radio, if you don't watch the Fox News Channel, you're not anywhere nearly as informed as people that are just hearing the bumper stickers, the slogans, the snippets, the commercials of the media.
This Week in Radical History, for the week starting December 8th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Some radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. And an audio segment is borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
On December 8th, 1980, John Lennon is gunned down outside his apartment in New York.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no country. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die.
December 8th, in 1982, American anti-nuclear weapons activist Norman Mayer was killed by the United States Park Police after he threatened to blow up the Washington Monument. Mayer had driven a white van, which he claimed was full of dynamite, to the base of the Washington Monument. He threatened to detonate it unless the U.S. agreed to seriously engage in a national dialogue on the threat of nuclear weapons. As Mayer moved back towards his van, the police opened fire on him, killing him. It was later discovered that he did not, in fact, have any explosive materials. The park police claimed that they did not intend to shoot Mayer, but were rather aiming at the van's engine. Mayer was shot 4 times, twice in the head. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
This Week in Radical History for December 9th, proving once again that this country was not founded on religious freedoms, like in the New World in 1640, when settler Hugh Bewitt is banished from the colonies for declaring himself to be free of original sin. Also on December 9th, 1842, the anarchist prince, the prince who became a revolutionary, the prince who shunned material wealth, Prince Peter Kropotkin, is born in Moscow. Though he grew up in privilege, he rejected it. Writer of many books, perhaps most famous is his 1902 published Mutual Aid, A Factor of Evolution, which provided an alternative view to animal and human survival. Here's a one-minute documentary segment on Kropotkin and the Russian anarchist revolution.
The Russian Revolution of 1917 was a spontaneous uprising of peasants and workers. All across Russia, workers organized factory committees, called Soviets, and popular assemblies in the villages.
Then the Bolsheviks, headed by Lenin, swiftly and ruthlessly imposed one-party rule. They claimed that the success of the revolution depended upon the people's obedience to the single rule of the leaders. The Cheka, the secret police, suppressed all non-Bolshevik factions, including the Russian anarchists. The great anarchist theoretician, Peter Kropotkin, returned from exile hoping to see his ideas of mutual aid put into practice. He died in 1921, disillusioned with the course of the revolution. Ironically, many imprisoned anarchists were permitted to attend his funeral, but it was the death knell for anarchism in Russia, and those lucky enough to escape, like Emma Goldman and Molly Steimer, reluctantly turned their backs on the country of their birth.
Years earlier, Michael Bakunin, one of anarchism's leading proponents, warned that the Marxists, instead of abolishing state power, would simply transfer it from one group to another. His words turned out to be prophetic. He said, Marx and his friends will concentrate all the powers of government in strong hands. The red bureaucracy will be the most violent, terrible lie our century has created.
More anarchist news, this time French news in 1893. Auguste Vallant will throw a small bomb into the Chamber of Deputies, a symbolic gesture meant to wound rather than kill. Vallant is condemned to death and guillotined, and deputies would use this event to suppress the anarchists. Vallant explained why he, an anarchist who strove for a society of peace, resorted to acts of violence. Quote, I have seen capital come, like a vampire, to suck the last drop of blood out of the unfortunate outcasts. When I came back to France, it was apparent to me where it was reserved for me to see my family suffer in the most terrible manner. This was the last drop in the cup of my sorrow. I tired of leading a life of suffering and cowardice. I carried this bomb to those who are primarily responsible for all society's miseries. Unquote. Also on December 9, 1953, General Electric announces all communist employees will be fired and fights union organizations. Representative John Ratkin of Mississippi uses his seat on the House Un-American Activities Committee to argue that blacks had been happy with segregation until stirred up by the communist agitators. General Electric President Charles Wilson said, quote, the problem of the U.S. can be summed up in two words, Russia abroad, labor at home. That's definitely more than two words, but who's counting? Last Anna State in 1981, black Philadelphia journalist and activist Mumia Abu-Jamal is arrested and charged with the killing of a Philadelphia policeman. Evidence would disappear, witnesses would be intimidated by police, police officers change their testimony to fit the official line, and the prosecutor would eventually be the judge considering Mamoul's appeal at his death sentence. And justice for all. Only got two items for December 10th, 1961. Clouds of radioactive steam escaped underground nuclear test site, closing several New Mexico highways. And this contamination will happen again 5 years later. Also on this date in 1980, radio commentator Paul Harvey scoffs at renewed calls for gun control in the wake of John Lennon's murder. Quote, well, now wait a minute, he says. Death has claimed a lot of rock musicians prematurely, and none with guns. Keith Moon, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, OD'd on drugs, and Elvis Presley and Brian Jones and John Bonham. Plane crashes killed Jim Croce and Otis Redding and Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, Ronnie Van Sant. In fact, Lennon at 40 lived much longer than most of those. Unquote. So it turns out that Lennon was really kind of lucky with repeatedly being shot in the back.
Now you know the rest of the story.
This Week in Radical History for December 11th, 1950, Bertrand Russell recommends that all warmongers spend time in a boat with shark-infested pool. He humbly suggests that they forget the part about the boat. 5 years later, he would co-write the Russell-Einstein Manifesto, along with Albert Einstein and nine other intellectuals of their day, calling for nuclear disarmament. Also on December 11, 1994, in the middle of the Russian invasion of Chechnya, Russian performance artist Alexander Brenner goes to Red Square with boxing equipment in the middle of the war campaign and shouts in the direction of the Kremlin, Yeltsin, come out! This week in Radical History for December 13, 1830, the state of Georgia makes it unlawful for Cherokee to meet in council, unless it is to propose the giving of lands to whites. Also on December 13, 1908, Seattle police take anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman into custody after a lock on a closed hall is broken to allow Emma entry to speak. She is only released when she agrees to leave the city. This is just one of many cities that will not allow her to speak. After being booted from the city of Seattle, Emma Goldman protests the action of the police authority in Everett, Washington, who prevent her from speaking on the claims that vigilantes might harm her. The attempted exercise in free speech remains a farce until she reaches Canada. Emma is also arrested in Burlington, Washington, in anticipation of her scheduled speech there. Words can be dangerous. This week in Radical History for December 14, 1763, 57 whites enter Conestoga Indian Settlement in violation of the treaty made between the tribe and William Penn. The treaty stated, quote, "to last as long as the sun should shine or the waters run in the rivers," unquote. The 57 whites shoot, stab, and hatchet 3 men, 2 women, and 1 young boy they found there. Also on that date in 1917, peace activist suffragette Kate Richardson O'Hare jailed 5 years for a speech denouncing World War I and occupies a neighboring cell to Emma Goldman. O'Hare is one of the number of prisoners Eugene Debs cited in his Canton speech, for which he, in turn, would be imprisoned. More dangerous words. Two more quick items for this date. 1971, Detective Frank Serpico tells Knapp Commission of widespread police corruption in New York. There's a movie loosely based on his life starring Al Pacino. Also in 1972, in the holiday spirit, President Nixon authorizes the Christmas bombing of Hanoi. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Apologies about last week's ending song, Prepare for Madness, and other great tunes can be found at MySpace as Underworld Superstars. Again, that's Underworld Superstars at the MySpace.com website. Underworld Superstars. Again, thanks for tuning into this week's show, and until next week's Radical History, I will always and forever be yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon. Slave or soldiers till you starve and your head is skewered on a stake. Now you can know where people are won. Now you can know where they get things done. What you need, my son? What you need, my son? We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we are going to be taking a look at the Jewish lobby and its manifestations at the local and national level. It was felt locally this week as the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority decided it would no longer accept advertisements about political or social issues following an outcry over a pro-Palestinian ad in the Davis Square Red Line T-stop. The ad, sponsored by the Palestine Advocacy Project, projects the word violence over the picture of a small girl with pigtails. The ad states that since September 2000, Israel's military has killed one Palestinian child every 3 days, and ends with the words, "Stop U.S. military aid to Israel." The vote banning such ads was taken at a board meeting of the MBTA and was attended by a large vocal representation from the organized Jewish community on one side and representatives of the Palestine Advocacy Project on the other. ACLU, which has represented the Palestine Advocacy Project's right to display the ad, testified that the First Amendment protects this type of public advocacy. And in fact, its earlier lawsuit had forced the MBTA to display the ad based on their current policy. That policy is now changed, and it remains to be seen whether the new policy will withstand First Amendment scrutiny in the courts. It is clear that the power of the Jewish lobby was on full display here, and although the ad was based on a verifiable fact, screams of anti-Semitism and hate speech fill the air. We will continue to cover this story as it moves forward to a probable new round of litigation by the ACLU. As part of their larger lobbying strategy, Jewish organizations such as the Jewish Community Relations Council has sponsored all expense-paid trips to Israel for community, religious, and political leaders for years and years, including local, state, and federal legislative representatives. Now, 10 Massachusetts state senators are due to leave for Israel on December 3rd on this all-expenses-paid junket. But this time, there is public pushback. Here are excerpts of an article published this week in Mondo Weiss, written by Nancy Murray, a member of the Boston Alliance for Water Justice, who recently led a group tour through the West Bank for the Interfaith Peace Builders. This article outlines the pushback strategy. Here is her rendering of events. All expenses paid junkets to Israel organized for elected officials and community leaders by a lobbying group, the Jewish Community Relations Council, JCRC, of Greater Boston, have generally attracted little public comment. But this is changing. On October 29th, Boston Globe staff reporter Frank Phillips raised the ethical issue of a trip being planned by the JCRC for a quarter of the Massachusetts Senate even as the Senate was voting to pass a JCRC-sponsored resolution that opposed any actions, campaigns, or movements that would in any way undermine, punish, or otherwise limit, isolate, or diminish any relations with Israel. And no sooner had the news of the trip been made public than members of the Boston Alliance for Water Justice got busy calling the offices of the 10 senators who are due to travel to Israel in early December. They pointed out the conflict of interest and asked the lawmakers to reconsider their participation in a delegation designed to present Israel in a positive light and mute international condemnation of its treatment of Palestinians. For nearly 2 years, the Boston Alliance has campaigned against the Innovative Water Partnership that the Patrick administration had formed with Israel, arguing that the Commonwealth should not be complicit in Israel's use of water as a weapon against the Palestinian people. Last month, they were encouraged to learn that the water partnership had been placed on hold for the foreseeable future. But with senators expressing an interest in knowing more about Israel's water technology and hoping to forge stronger business and economic ties, joint water projects could again be on the agenda. Israel's discriminatory water policies may have brought the 8 organizations that currently constitute the Boston Alliance for Water Justice together, but their larger concerns are with Israel's nearly 50-year-long military occupation and the shoot-to-kill impunity and massive human rights abuses being used to sustain it. They want Massachusetts lawmakers to reject economic collaboration with Israel until it complies with international law by ending its occupation and its dispossession and oppression of Palestinians. Boston Alliance member groups summarized their concern in 10 Reasons Why Senators Should Not Go on This Trip, a document that accompanies a petition signed by 1,200 Massachusetts residents. The petition reads, "Massachusetts State Senators, Don't Go to Israel." And it is addressed to State Senate President Stan Rosenberg and State Senators Ben Downing, Ann Gobey, John Keenan, Barbara Letalian, Karen Spilka, Michael Barrett, Eileen Donahue, Richard Ross, and Dan Wolf. "We, Massachusetts voters, are dismayed that you intend to go to Israel on a junket to foster closer economic and cultural ties between the Commonwealth and Israel. While the Israeli government continues to implement increasingly draconian violations of international law and human rights against Palestinians, your trip would serve as an endorsement of Israeli policies. Until Israel abides by international law, we encourage you to oppose the use of Massachusetts taxpayer dollars to fund collaborations with the State of Israel." Fresh eyewitness testimony about Israel's repressive policies and practices that the senators are unlikely to encounter on a JCRC junket was provided at the press conference and detailed in an open letter to the senators. The letter was signed by 7 Massachusetts residents who had just a week before returned from being a part of an interfaith peace builders delegation to Israel-Palestine. Following the press conference, this document and copies of the petition were delivered to the offices of each senator as well as the governor, who has expressed an interest in traveling to Israel at some point. That was an excerpt from an article written by Nancy Murray in Mondo Weiss. While there is hope that the senators will not go on the trip to Israel, the senators are being sent the names of Palestinians they might like to speak to if they go. They are also being encouraged to go into the West Bank to see the conditions on the other side of the wall. And now a look at the inside of the Jewish lobby by a man well qualified to do so, M.J. Rosenberg is a journalist who has worked for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, and as a congressional staffer on Capitol Hill. Here he is speaking at a conference sponsored by the Massachusetts Peace Action's Palestine Working Group. The presentation begins with his introduction.
Speaker, M.J. Rosenberg is another longtime observer and trenchant analyst of U.S. policy towards Israel-Palestine. As I'm sure most of you know, Rosenberg brings the perspective, the unique perspective of an insider to the activities of the Israel lobby, whom he originally worked for and whose activities he later came to deplore. During the 1980s, Rosenberg served as editor of the Near East Report, AIPAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. This was followed by 15 years on the Hill as an aide to various Democratic members of Congress, where he acquired invaluable firsthand experience of how actually AIPAC works on Congress to shape U.S. policy on the Middle East. This firsthand experience is reflected in the many highly critical columns he wrote for Media Matters during 2009 to 2012, which many of us eagerly awaited for his insights about just what AIPAC was up to at any particular moment in time. When Media Matters, a progressive news center, turned out to be progressive except for Palestine, Rosenberg resigned.
I was fired, but then I resigned.
Well, that's interesting. Oh, yeah. I didn't want to use that word, and yeah. It was absolutely...
Oh, I was, yeah.
No doubt that there was a lot of pressure. Absolutely. His columns can now be read in The Nation magazine and Huffington Post. M.J. Rosenberg.
Oh, thank you. Thank you all for being here. Politics is my life, so I like to, you know, see people involved with it. It's so important. You know, we always hear it, but I was thinking yesterday, and I know, don't yell at me if this seems like an exaggeration and I'm like a far-out crazy person, but in my opinion, what happened in Paris and what's happened in all these other places around the world with terrorism, a large part of it lays at the fact that the 2000 presidential election in the United States was stolen. This is all George Bush, Iraq War, neocons, all these people. It's not, these things just don't happen. And so I just think it's always, you know, and I think my cause this year is going to be, if anyone tells me that they're not voting in the November 2000 election because their favorite candidate didn't get nominated, I'm strangling that person. I mean, really, it is just so important, except not important for any of you because you can vote for whoever you want because you live in Massachusetts. But, you know, it's still important. We in Maryland, my home state, we always say we can vote for whoever we want. And last time we didn't like the Democratic nominee. None of us could stand the Democratic nominee, so a lot of us didn't vote for him. We have a Republican governor. So, you know, it does matter. I want to say something. This is a prelude to my optimistic main thing. I want to talk about the Jews a little bit, of which I am not proudly one. Proudly is stupid to anything I didn't choose. So I'm like, oh, I'm proud. I'm a proud male. Okay. Any movement to change for progressive politics in America has to involve the Jewish community. Every movement in America, every progressive movement, the last time a progressive movement was not heavily, almost to the point of dominated by Jews in this country, was William Jennings Bryan in 1896, when they were arguing about bimetallism and silver and whatever that crazy stuff was, when it was the farmers, because Jews were never been big farmers. That wasn't their issue. The Jews, I mean, if you think about labor, the GLBT movement, the women's movement, I mean, the anti-war movement, was there a Vietnam War for those older people out there like me, was there a Vietnam War demonstration movie? If you took the Jews out, there would have been 10 people standing around. I mean, the women's movement, when you look at the people like Bella Abzug and Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan, and you know, it's just like, we can't, they can't, but the good news is the Jews are coming back. What they have been is out AWOL on this issue because of that phrase that we are progressive except for Palestine. That is changing. It's not changing necessarily among our generation, the older people. Sadly enough, the 60s generation has turned out to be a big flop when it comes to the Israel-Palestinian issue. They're as bad as their parents were. But the kids are really different. I mean, and now you see, you know, J Street and Jewish Voice for Peace and the Open Hillel movement, and overarching all that is the fact that it is not cool to be down with Israel for Jewish kids anymore. It is a controversial position to take. And it's like, whereas when I was in school, I mean, and any of you were in school, if, particularly if you were Jewish, or if you weren't, the default position was pro-Israel. Mm-hmm. It's not anymore. And if you're a it's not... I do a lot of stuff with campuses. I know what goes on campuses. You're the pro, I won't call it pro-Israel. I hate the phrase pro-Israel because they support policies that will lead to the destruction of Israel. So why is that called pro-Israel? If you're supporting Netanyahu, you're supporting the end of the Jewish state. I mean, really? We'll use the term the way they use it. The pro-Israel kids, the AIPAC kids, are on the defensive. Which is why a movement like BDS, which is not that big a movement and hasn't had these great victories yet, drives them insane. Why are they so hysterical about BDS if BDS isn't accomplishing something? It's obviously accomplishing something. And I think, I mean, to have people like Stuart Eisenstadt, you know, a big shot in the United States government, who, oh my God, he's hysterical about BDS. Hear that. Can I say it in the grounds of Harvard? To hear that pig Alan Dershowitz talking about, I mean, what is... If everything is going in their direction, what the hell are they so afraid of? And they're afraid all the time. I got fired from Media Matters because they were afraid. You know what I did? Well, it was Alan Dershowitz who got me fired, so hey, Alan. I may be retired, but you're senile. What Alan Dershowitz did... He took out an ad in the New York Times, which said, and this is the way AIPAC and their bunch operates, if MJ Rosenberg continues working at Media Matters and continues using the word Israel Firster, which I kind of coined the idea of calling them Israel Firsters, if he stays there, I will not support the Democratic Party, I will not support Democratic, now, blah, 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 and neither will any of my friends. And within, I mean, at the time I didn't admit it, but now it's so many years later I can say it, I was fired within a week. I mean, the big donors picked up the phone and made threats. And that is how it works. That is how it's been working in this country for decades. If the Palestinian movement is the civil rights issue of our age, the pro-Israel movement is the McCarthyist issue of our age, which is why it's very hard for candidates to say what they think. I'm appalled by what both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders say about Israel. But on the other hand, I know what they're up against. They're up against money power. 40% of the money that goes to the Democratic Party is bundled by AIPAC. 40%. You can't. Wow. The Republicans have so many sources to get money from. Everyone, every industry in the country will support the Republicans because they're the pro-business party. The Democrats have very few obvious sources. And one of the big ones are the Jews. And they insist, members of Congress and presidential candidates, in believing that the Jews all stand behind Netanyahu. And it's a lie. I worked on Capitol Hill for 20 years. You know how they think up there? If someone named Rosenthal says, Congressman Kennedy, here's $50 because I love you and I support you, when Congressman Kennedy sees the name Rosenthal, he assumes this is money I'm getting because I support Israel. That's a great accomplishment that AIPAC has done when, in fact, according to the American Jewish Committee, which is the definitive poll every 4 years that's done about issues that Jews care about, it's the largest poll, no competition. The number of Jews, the percentage of Jews who in any election vote or give money based on Israel is 4 to 6%. The overwhelming issues are for Jews is equality, civil rights, gay rights, environmental issue, all these other issues. You add the Palestinian component to it as a progressive issue, that's going to be, I mean, yeah, the fact of the matter is a lot of the people who are promoting Palestinian rights on the Hill and in Washington are Jews. We have to change the face of it so that they see, so that they begin to understand, just because you're Jewish, just because you're this, you're not supporting Netanyahu. It's hard for them to understand because they're debts. Most of them. I have to say that. They really are. I mean, I have to. I worked for so many good ones. I worked for Carl Levin, who was absolutely brilliant, but was terrified of the lobby as well. I mean, so you could be depressed about their power, and I was, and then came the Iran vote. I was absolutely sure that Obama was going to lose. Why? Because, amazingly enough, around 10 years ago, AIPAC decided that that their number one goal was no longer to maintain the occupation and make life miserable for Palestinians. Their number one goal is a war with Iran. A war with Iran that Israel would start and that the United States would come in right behind. They have been pushing all the sanctions, the sanctions bills, all the punitive stuff on Iran for over 15 years. It's been 15 years they've promoted it, and it all culminated this year on this vote. And Obama said, no, I'm doing this. Kerry said no. And then the Democratic Party lined up, amazingly enough, not behind the Prime Minister of Israel, but behind the President of the United States. And it was everyone. It was some of the worst members. Steny Hoyer, who is the minority leader of the House, he's AIPAC's enforcer. He's not Jewish, so he's perfect. He's their enforcer. If you don't support this, you're going to lose money. He voted with the president. And he would refuse to enforce for them. Cory Booker, this awful senator from New Jersey, who has been involved with AIPAC his entire life, voted against AIPAC on this issue. Overwhelmingly, 90% of the Jewish members of the House and Senate supported Obama and not Netanyahu. Remember when Chuck Schumer made his announcement? Everyone thought, that's it. All the Jewish senators and everything were going to fall into line. You know, no one fell into line except Ben Cardin of Maryland. No one ever heard of him. So, I mean, it's really changing. And for the first time in my life, I feel really good. I don't feel defensive. I think the word defensiveness is really important. Certain issues, you know you're winning when you see who's defensive. Gay rights, for instance. Who's defensive on that issue? I mean, the people who support it or the people who are trying to, you know, who are trying to stop it? African Americans, the whole civil rights movement. Who's defensive? The ones who want the flag or the ones who don't want the flag? Who, you know, it's like, and this, the Palestinian issue has become one now where, and I know lots of Palestinians, and as my life has progressed, I know, sadly or happily, I know many more Palestinians than I know Israelis. It used to be very different. But I know none of the Palestinians I know fear for the future. They're optimistic about the future. They're depressed about what's going on right now, but they're confident about the future. It's the Jewish right Remember, the Jewish right, not all Jews, the Jewish right that's scared all the time. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? What's going to happen is the occupation is going to end. And as Rami said, this issue is going to be resolved because, amazingly enough, it is one of the easier issues to resolve. We all have known what the solution is going to be for years and years. It's just that each time we get close, I recommend for anyone, if you haven't read it, read The Truth About Camp David by Clayton Swisher, which explains how the Israelis sabotaged 2000. We were on the brink. You know, you read it. You know, do you know what? I just have to. This one thing drives me insane. That Arafat, the whole Rabin Arafat agreement was this. You know, was to be done in these stages and to be this 5-year transition period. And each, and then the Israelis would hand over territory in stages, incrementally, to the Palestinians. And when they got to the, when the Palestinians controlled 90%, at that point they would go into what Rabin and Arafat called final status negotiations to end the conflict once and for all. Barak, Ehud Barak, who came in as the peace prime minister, he immediately, first thing he did was he dropped the Palestinians completely and decided he would negotiate with Syria. Nobody was demanding to negotiate, but that was what he decided to do. Then when he got to it, he turned to Clinton and said, we have to make the Palestinians show their bad faith early. Let's go to negotiations immediately. Let's not wait till the Palestinians have 90%. Let's do it now. And Clinton went along with it, and the game worked perfectly. Arafat was not able to deliver at that point. The Palestinians had gained basically nothing from the Oslo deal. And Barak got what he wanted, was Intifada II. And nothing good has happened since. As, not to name drop, as President Bill Clinton said to me in 1997, okay, it was to name drop, he said Yigal Amir was the only assassin in history who achieved all his goals. The bullet that killed Arafat, killed the peace process, and unless, I mean, killed Rabin, killed the peace, we'll talk about the Arafat part later, killed Rabin, and unless we do something, that same process that, you know, that lost Rabin, that ended Oslo, that gave us Intifada II, what's waiting in the wings are the terrorists that we are seeing in the streets of Paris. Israel doesn't want to negotiate. They say they can't talk with Hamas. If this continues at the rate things are going, they'll be begging to talk with Hamas. I mean, the point is, the only answer is talking. The only answer is negotiating. But the good news is more and more people are coming around. That's why you are lucky to hear me speak in one of the few optimistic speeches I've ever given. Thank you.
Mr. M.J. Rosenberg, two questions. One, AIPAC lost the Iran nuclear deal and lost a lot of support. Is that going to be maintained? And the other is, if we've known for years what the result, what the final resolution of the occupation is, given what's happened on the ground, how do we get there?
Okay, I'm going to punt on part number two and let the others deal with part two. I'm going to let the others deal with part two. Let me just address the issue of part one. AIPAC.
Hold it close.
Is it this one? Oh, can you hear this? Okay. I'm going to just address the question about AIPAC and Congress, and is the momentum, the good momentum, going to last? I neglected to mention that in our victory on the Iran vote, they couldn't even get a Senate vote. Do you remember at the end it was kind of like they were desperately fighting, just let's get the Senate to go on record, and Obama said no. And there was no vote. It was just, you know, the president was sustained. The reason it's going to continue is because the illusion of power is everything. And AIPAC lost that illusion. In the old days, which was, it was yesterday, but it could be, they would go after anyone who signed a pro-Palestinian letter. They would go after them by, sending money to the opponents, all that kind of stuff. That's how they operate. That's what their strength is made of. They made a decision. I saw this in the Washington Post. They're not going after the people who voted wrong on Iran. They have decided to give everybody a pass. Well, once they start giving passes on Iran, how much harder is it to not give a pass on, let's say, a Palestine issue like this letter that we're talking about? So I do think that as long as we do our work and intensify our work, I think we've got them on the run now. I think the momentum, they have all the money. I mean, that's really a big thing in politics. But for the first time, they've lost. So that's got to be worth something. And they lost on the issue that is, for them, a life and death issue and the biggest issue of all. And they lost. So I'm pretty optimistic that we at least can start making some real inroads.
Okay. Pat?
Yes, they lost, but they increased by 50% the aid. And so did they lose?
What do I do about that? Well, they did lose, and they didn't increase by 50% yet. That's still just a discussion thing between, the aid, I don't see any real possibility for the time being of stopping the aid or linking the aid. It's so amazing with aid. Do you know that none of the states get federal money without strings attached? You don't get Department of Education money without agreeing to do all these things. Mm-hmm. Only Israel gets money with no strings attached. But I think it would be a real uphill battle at this point to go after that, though I'm 100% for it. I think at first the first job is on more of the humanitarian issues, political rights issues, those kinds of questions with Palestinians. Because if we're seen as going after the aid right away, then they immediately point to us, oh, you're anti-Israel. Aid is our lifeline. So I think we have to, but I do think, after all, the fact of the matter is, if you linked aid, you'd pretty much solve the problem, really. But that's an uphill struggle.
The woman in white, I can't... Yes, you.
Just a quick follow-up on what you just said. That's a point of accuracy. I've always understood that of all the money that we give to Israel, something like 70% has to come back to buy our weapons. So the unholy alliance between our government and our military is that an accurate statement?
Well, it was an accurate statement in the old days when I don't have the mic. You're doing a terrible job. No, I'm kidding. You're doing a great job. Okay, I'll give it back to you, though. Okay. They used to always pride themselves, the Israelis, on the fact that all the money that we gave them in terms of weapons, that it had to be spent here. But a few years ago, they decided they didn't really want to spend it here. They dropped that provision. They're no longer making those presentations of your money comes back to you in Iowa, your money. No, they decided that wasn't convenient, so they got rid of that too. So but in general, it's an unholy alliance because ultimately, who else are you going to really? They're not going to be buying these airplanes from the Russians. So they are. So Boeing and McDonnell Douglas and all these things. So it's a really good point. Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to go to the very back. Is that Susan?
Yes.
Yes. So, if you can wait for the mic, though.
Is there
a reason why this doesn't work?
Could you guys just share down there?
Oh, yeah, we'll share.
If it works. Okay.
None of them work?
But maybe we can use this one.
Great job, all three of you. Really appreciate this. So, there are these universities that have affiliation agreements with universities in Palestine. So Bard College and Brandeis University had affiliation agreements with Al-Quds University in Abu Dis in the West Bank. So 2 years ago, I did a sabbatical there, and I witnessed the jihad rally on campus that caused Brandeis to cut its ties with Al-Quds. And there was absolutely no evidence whatsoever that these were students at Al-Quds. In fact, I'm almost certain they were not, because I was there. There were people who came in from the outside dressed from head to toe in black, only with eye slits. So there was absolutely no way to identify these people. But nonetheless, it was what appeared to be a jihad rally, and I don't understand enough Arabic to know what they said, but Brandeis cut their ties. And the Boston Globe reported it as a rally that was caused by Al-Quds students. It wasn't. But do you see any change in that kind of direction? I mean, none of us, I don't think any of us here, could really justify a jihad rally, even though we're very pro-Palestine. You know, they were stomping on Israeli flags and everything. It was pretty horrible. But like I said, I'm almost certain they were not Al-Quds students, even though the media was told that they were. What do we do about situations like that?
Are you directing this to one of the speakers?
Any one of you. What do we do about situations like that when we're really staunch advocates of Palestinian rights? This puts us in a real quandary.
I just want to say on that one thing, that the fact that it was Brandeis that even had the program, I'm into the thing of looking at things half full today. Brandeis is a Jewish university, so it's really you or your colleagues or whatever are to be commended that there was such a program. But over and over again, they look for every opportunity to taint anything that's Arab or Palestinian or Muslim with terrorism. So I really think there's very little that people can do when you're up against people who are just lying to you. But as far as the actual people, you might know more about. Do you?
The Boston Globe reported it as a rally that was started by students. And so I was there, and so I read it online, and I wrote, I'm here right now. I witnessed this. They were not our students. But that didn't make
any
difference.
Can I say something? I was teaching at Al-Quds Bard College at the time.
Hold on.
Are these questions?
I don't know.
Well, you may say something, but it has to be brief.
Okay. This is a tempest in a teapot. There was such a rally. Al-Quds University has free speech for organizations. It has free speech for Hamas, free speech for Fatah, free speech. And every year, every organization has a week or two in which they have demonstrations and flags and the whole business. This particular event was a memorial of when the Mossad assassinated their leader, okay, about 20 years ago, and it was a one-day event. Yes, they dressed in black, and it was no big deal for the students there. It was no big deal for the faculty there. It was not a declared. It was a memorial service and a declaration, you're not going to kill us. You know, we're opposed to your killing us.
Okay.
That's what they were saying.
Clarification appreciated. I'm going to ask preferentially if people have questions they'd like to direct to our other two speakers. Please. Okay.
This is directed to the whole essence of this convivium that, and I think you brought this out very well, that maybe we should change our focus a little bit and get to the very heart of this without being offensive. If the Jews can be convinced, not only in this country but in the world, that this situation is not good for the Jews, that's the heart of this. And if the Jews can be convinced that through Israel, through other of the actions, they've frittered away the goodwill that they had at the instant of the establishment of Israel. Whether that would have happened without the Holocaust or not, I doubt. And they had the world's goodwill. They've lost it. And by them losing it, all the Jews in this country and all the rest of the Jews in the world are losing it also. And once every Jew understands that the present situation isn't good for the Jews,
Okay, understood. Was that a question to anyone?
No,
It's a question as to whether that emphasis should be tried.
Okay. You're welcome to respond if anybody wants to respond.
I agree. I think that will be very. You have people like the mainstream Jewish organizations and the Israeli government that will take that, what you just said, flip it over and say, you see, we're losing the support of everybody. That's why Israel needs more. I mean, so it's, you know, Israel has Netanyahu's approach is like no other Israeli leader in that he kind of likes. The previous Israeli leaders, well, before Begin anyway, the ones like Ben-Gurion and Rabin and those guys, Golda Meir, they used to say it's a new day, we're strong, the Jews don't have to be afraid of anybody. Netanyahu's approach, which is also one of the reasons they're losing the kids, is it's 1942, and the Holocaust is about to happen. And my answer to that would be, really? If it's 1942, what exactly has Israel accomplished? I mean, it's not 1942. They lie. I want to say, well, I have the microphone. I'm going to hog it for 1 second. I left out a key point I need to say. It has to do with Elizabeth Warren and hassling members of Congress. I worked for them for 20 years. They do not like anyone disagreeing with them. They like to have events in their living rooms or in a meeting where everybody applauds them and tells them how wonderful they were. Any of you saw the YouTube of Bernie Sanders during the Gaza war? He was as nice as could be until the Palestinian supporters started mentioning Gaza, and he lost his game completely. It's important to hassle them, and that means even writing letters to the local paper. I mean the local, whatever the Brookline paper is, or, you know, the Watertown paper, in which you just say, do you know that, you know, I was disappointed that. Mm-hmm. It really drives them crazy. And not to let them get away with being good on the issues that are easy for them. For all these years, you guys, no offense, let Barney Frank get away with being awful on this issue because he's so wonderful on everything else. And now, as a sidelight, it's his sister, Ann Lewis, who's the number one person on the Hillary Clinton campaign, whose job is to keep her on the right side of this issue. Can't do that anymore. You know, Barney, it's easy for you to be a spokesman on gay rights. That's easy. Who in Brookline is going to give you a hard time about that? And the fact of the matter is, what makes you a leader is taking stands on the ones that are hard. And that's why, and you don't give them a pass on Palestine.
Is Barney Frank in our audience tonight?
That was journalist M.J. Rosenberg speaking at the conference sponsored by Massachusetts Peace Action Palestinian Working Group. One more story before we have to leave. There is a raging controversy in the United States and throughout the world concerning the immigration of Syrian refugees. The tension between security considerations and humanitarian outreach is at the center of the debate. There is immense pressure to relieve the suffering of thousands of men, women, and children literally fleeing for their lives. But Israel seems to be on a different planet. There is no consideration for helping out during this immigration crisis. In fact, they are even denying entry to Palestinians who were born and brought up there, who have been out of the country trying to return. Put this story in juxtaposition with the Syrian crisis. On October 10, 2015, Amin Hussein was denied entry into Palestine while returning to be with family and friends. He was deported by Israel after 15 hours of detention, interrogation, a strip search, and a body cavity search. The official reason given was for the prevention of illegal immigration and public security or public safety or public order considerations. Hussein writes, "I am not the first Palestinian to be denied entry into their homeland, nor will I be the last. but it is clear that Israel has escalated this practice, and we should discover effective ways to fight it.
The power of the media is great and growing. It has a very close relationship with politicians, I think a slightly incestuous one, each trying to influence the other, and it is a struggle for power. You see, wealth and power are indivisible. In the old days it was land and factories, but now it is really the control of information that is the greatest power that the wealthy have.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Are we being dragged into a war in Syria or with Syria? Or I suppose you could say even for Syria. As the mainstream media broadcasts and prints wall-to-wall reasons to bomb Syria and shows pictures of RAF jets against the sunset rather than the devastation below, we look at the veil, behind the veil, of this post-9/11 neocon era. Well, what do we see? We see NATO's unending wars and the balkanisation of the Middle East, hearing from some of the neocons behind it all later. And we ask, while many of the fighters were trained next door in Jordan, why has ISIS not been attacking their supposed mortal enemy, Israel? Putin is welcoming Britain's support in Syria, but will Russia and NATO ultimately end up fighting over control of Syria and Syria's oil? And claims of 70,000 moderate rebels ready to fight on the ground in support of the RAF and American Air Force. Last we heard, there were only 70. Where did the extra 70,000 come from? Can we rely on the source of this information? Who is the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee? Plus, closer to home, what is Bristol's own Stop the War group? Our city's so-called terrorist sympathisers, what are they planning? And to ask that very question, I'm joined in the studio by Jim from Bristol Stop the War. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there. Nice for you to have me on the show.
Jim, tell us a bit about what you're planning, what your reaction has been here in the city.
Well, following the 2,000-strong demonstration on Wednesday night, which went on to a blockade that lasted till at least 8 o'clock when I left, we're going to have a stall in Broadmead, at Tesco Broadmead, this Saturday. That will start out as a stall, but hopefully, if there's enough people, we'll do some action, a demonstration or a rally.
Now, you've lost the argument, though, so why don't you just go home?
Well, can I just announce another two actions? So, following on from that, on Wednesday, a group of six former school children have carried out an initiative, which will be a 5:30 p.m. demo on Wednesday at the Fountains. So we hope thousands of people will turn out to show that they don't believe the government's fantasy stories. And of course, I'm also going to announce the Saturday week event in London, which London and Britain's Stop the War group have called in national demonstration. And you can find out more on the website.
Yeah, I noticed there was a big demonstration on Wednesday, wasn't there, outside the Houses of Parliament. Not a lot of coverage directly from there. One of the other things I noticed just driving on Wednesday evening is Radio Wales, which I know the Welsh often get very het up about things like this, particularly as they're quite, shall we say, they have a certain rivalry across the Severn. And lo and behold, the BBC Radio Wales' phone lines were all out, so they couldn't have any people phoning in expressing their views all evening on Wednesday over in Wales. But what are your thoughts about the whole vote, Jim? Because ultimately what's happened here is you've just been voted out, haven't you? I'm afraid there is going to be bombing of Syria.
Well, that's true, but at least half the population of the country aren't convinced, particularly by Cameron's fantasy army, which rivals the Chinese terracotta army in its mystery. And I think that the people are very worried about this strategy. Is it simply bungling? Are they incompetent? Or are they just preparing the ground for, literally, for ground troops to go in at some further time and do what they want to do, which is regime change against Assad?
Now, this number of 70,000 does sound a little bit familiar, doesn't it? It's almost like back in 2003 we were told 45 minutes Saddam could be launching chemical, biological weapon attacks.
Well, with so many millions of Syrians leaving the country, isn't it likely the most moderate Syrians are on their way out of the country, leaving only those prepared to take up arms against the Assad regime? You may or may not like it, but they're unlikely to be moderate people.
Or some of them for the Assad regime.
For the Assad regime.
Because yeah. Because there's a conscription now right across Syria, has been for quite a while. What is your main reason why you think that this is the wrong thing to do then, Jim?
Well, into a very complicated situation, we're just adding our tuppence worth of bombing without a clear strategy, precluding a real look at economic and other political actions that could be carried out. There's not been much attempt to cut off ISIS's wealth and its sale of oil, clearly via Turkey, which the Russians have pointed out. Now, why isn't that the main thing? This gang can't continue its rampaging without an awful lot of money and armaments. They're being backed by Turkey surreptitiously. Why aren't we closing the border at Turkey? They've got enough troops in NATO to do that, and that could just involve beefing up the border at Turkey.
Now, back in September, I was listening to the Iranian president saying, well, the American satellites, surely they can see see the newsprint that you're reading if you're sitting in a park reading a newspaper, and they can see the number plate on your car from their satellite. How come they can't see these oil transactions going on? Like, how come they can't spot those? And they've been bombing for nearly a year.
They can spot them, but what they're claiming is that they're civilian targets and therefore they're out of combat. Now, this is clearly absurd. They've been bombing civilian targets for decades, so all of a sudden they can't identify ISIS and their oil pipeline, their oil transit. And it's clearly some very dubious politics going on behind the scene, identified most obviously by the Russians after their aircraft was downed. And it just really shows that the whole coalition strategy is based on not just a fantasy strategy militarily, but also very dubious politically.
But you seem to be implying that what the Russians have been doing is the right thing, and yet we're going to be joining the Russians in bombing ISIS.
Well,
they've been doing that for several couple of months now.
We can't avoid the idea that different people are in Stop the War. It's a broad coalition. Some people support what Russia's doing. Other people are very dubious about it. The fact is, however, is that the Russians have been invited in by the Syrian government, giving it some legality. We haven't been invited in by anyone. We're just blundering.
But whole areas of northern Syria are really now denied to the Syrian government. They're not really part of Syria in any practical sense, are they?
Not practically, no. But are we helping to broker an agreement? We had an agreement possibility raised by Russia 2 years ago, I think it was, and it was just dismissed out of hand by the West. And now things have got so bad, we're going to go in, blunder in again, and continue bombing. How does that help?
Now, before we hear from Martin on this, let's go back to Wednesday again to the debate in the House of Commons. And Angus Robertson, who's the leader of the SNP, Scottish National Party, in Westminster, brought up the thorny issue you mentioned there, Jim, of this 70,000 moderate rebels which are going to help us. And you can also hear he allows here interventions both from the chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, which involves ordinary MPs. Let's just make it clear that you've got two main intelligence committees, the Joint Intelligence Committee, who were the ones that came out with the claim of 70,000 moderate rebels, and you've also got the Intelligence and Security Committee, which is made up of MPs. The Joint Intelligence Committee is mainly civil servants, like the head of the Ministry of Defence, the head of MI5, MI6, GCHQ, etc., and it is extremely secretive, but we're only allowed to know the name of the guy who's the chairman. A lot of the other members of it, I had a look on the government's website. You're not even allowed to know who they are. So there are these two tiers, really. One is slightly more open to ordinary MPs. And Dominic Grieve is the chairman of that Intelligence and Security Committee. And also we hear an intervention in Angus Robertson's speech, also from Yasmin Qureshi, who's on the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. So let's have a listen to that excerpt from the debate now.
If my esteemed colleague, the chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, is able to answer the question, I would be delighted.
What interests me about the argument that the Right Honourable Gentleman is putting forward is he raises perfectly legitimate questions, which should, I hope, be answered in the course of the debate.
Yes.
But what he glosses over is what his and his party's position is on the current operations, which I think he will agree with me, are in fact controlling Daesh's ability to do violence and cruelty in the area and terrorism in Europe.
It's a fair question.
And if indeed those actions at the moment involving our allies both in Syria and Iraq are achieving that goal, I find it very difficult to understand how he can argue that we ourselves should not cooperate in northern Syria. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. At the greatest respect for the Right Honourable Gentleman, and he makes good points, and I will come on later in my comments to some of the questions that he makes, but I just note respectfully again that we haven't heard an answer to the question which I've posed, and from the government front bench, you have the opportunity again, if they wish, to
this
tell
is
the
about
House
the 70,000 moderate rebels.
So I will make some. If the Honourable Gentleman can answer the question, I'd be delighted.
I thank the Right Honourable Gentleman for giving way. As member of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, part of the committee, I was in the Middle East last week. We went to Cairo, we went to Amman, and we went to Beirut, cities which has also suffered destruction. Yes. We spoke to military people, counter-terrorism people, the politicians. The answer that you see, I can tell you how many people there are. It's about 10 to 15,000, and that was the answer given by everyone there.
Goodness. Oh. Goodness. My goodness, Mr. Speaker, that's a very, very important intervention from the Honourable Lady.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from her experience and having travelled the region, she is suggesting that the government's figures that we have been provided are massively wrong.
So that's those figures were provided by John Day, J-O-N, John Day, who's the chairman of the joint, I lose count of these committees, the Joint Intelligence Committee, Martin.
Well, I think this is the big Achilles heel of this whole thing, isn't it? In actual fact, we have been supporting rebels, if we want to call them that, inside Syria. Some would call them terrorists. The Free Syrian Army, for example, who are the so-called moderates, they were the people that ripped out the Syrian soldiers' liver and ate it on camera in order to intimidate the locals. The Free Syrian Army also, many of whom are actually not Syrian at all, like Abdul Hakim Belhaj, who was of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, they were assassinating people who were postal workers because they were working for the evil government of Assad. These are the moderates that are going to be supported and have been supported by our own intelligence services and special forces.
Well, let's have a look at this slightly shadowy guy, John Day, who's put his name to this figure of 70,000. He was appointed chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee at the Cabinet Office in March 2012. Prior to his appointment, he was the second permanent secretary at the Ministry of Defence, basically MOD's top civil servant. His other career highlights are Director General of Ministry of Defence Security Policy, leading on NATO nuclear and security policy. He's also MOD Director Operational Policy, dealing with Iraq and Afghanistan, Chief of Staff to Lord Robertson, the NATO Secretary General, Chief of the Joint Intelligence Committee Assessment Staff, also MOD Director of Defence Policy, and NATO Head of Force Planning, actually at NATO, Martin.
Yes, well, I mean, NATO is a very interesting organisation because the Italian police investigated NATO in the 70s and the 80s and came to the very firm conclusion, as the head of the Supreme Court in Posimato made clear, that NATO were, in fact, people as an organisation involved in committing acts of terrorism and organising people to commit those acts, both fascist and so-called left-wing terrorists.
But with such
terrorists,
glorious career, how can he get this so wrong? We've heard from on the ground 15,000, and yet he's saying 70,000.
Well, whatever we're talking about, they call them moderates, and the point I was making is there are hardly any moderates in the opposition in Syria. As Jim was pointing out earlier, those who take up arms against the government of their country are not necessarily to be classed as moderates. And if, for example, the oppressed Muslims of Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which was the elected government of Egypt, were to take up arms against the Egyptian government, would that be justifiable? Some would say yes, some would say no, but many would accuse them of being terrorists. If there were moderates in Syria who were opposed to the in Saudi Arabia, who were opposed to that country's completely illegal invasion of Yemen or the invasion of Bahrain, was to take up arms, would they be moderates or would they be terrorists? And the other point I would also make in relation to what the British government decided to do on Wednesday and the British Parliament agreed with is it's got no basis in international law. All the legal opinions I've been reading suggest that there is no legal basis for what's going on.
Well, there is, because they've been to the UN Security Council who have passed a resolution saying all means necessary.
No, no.
Now, don't tell me that doesn't mean...
No, that's a misinterpretation. The UN Security Council said that everybody should cooperate together to fight ISIS, but in actual fact, the reason the Russians agreed to it was because, in principle, that meant that the Syrians should decide who is and who is not part of their coalition to take on ISIS. Now, I see the politics of what has happened is that the Russians have decided to say, thank you very much, Britain, for bombing ISIS. You're joining our coalition. But in actual fact, the official position of the Syrian government is that no foreign planes should be in Syrian airspace. And since we've had a situation where the Turks have shot down a Russian fighter bomber, what will happen further down the line, for example, if the Russians decide, if we try to remove Assad? This is what's going on behind the scenes here. ISIS is being used as a cat's paw to get a coalition together to go and try and overthrow Assad in a situation which is no longer viable. And of course the Russians and the Kurdish militia forces are closing down ISIS's supply line, which is actually being held by Turkmen based groups who are not in fact from inside Syria. The guy who claimed to have killed the Russian pilot is actually a Turkish national, and he's actually a member of the Grey Wolves, which are a right-wing terrorist group which has killed hundreds of people in Turkey. And people in Turkey know that this is how the world works. Middle-class Britons, many of them in the Houses of Parliament, are basically ignoramuses when it comes to talking about a lot of this stuff. I mean, this frankly is fantasy stuff. I mean, Stephen Fry was saying, and there are 70,000 moderate rebels made up of the Ents, the dwarves, and the Riders of Rohan, you know.
Before we go back to hear from Jim, Stop the War, let's go back to the debate on Wednesday and hear from a local MP for North Somerset, Liam Fox, a short clip from his speech.
We have not chosen this conflict, but we cannot ignore it. Yeah, yeah. To do nothing is a policy position which will have its own consequences. If we do act, it doesn't mean we will not see a terrorist atrocity in this country, but if we do not tackle Daesh at source over there, there will be an increasing risk that we have to face the consequences over here.
Well, he's talking, that's Liam Fox there, Conservative, who voted for the motion, about tackling this at its source. It's no good trying to deal with the consequences, Jim. We've got to get to the root of the problem.
Well, the root of the problem has been there for several years, where we know that Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Turkey have been funding ISIS. Turkey's quite was for some time, until it was pointed out on the international field, quite happy for ISIS to exist. It helps it for some spurious Turkish empire that it fancies itself having. We know that ISIS has got links to the CIA. We know a lot of things. What's really disturbing is that more people are going to be bombed and killed while fantasy politics is played out and deeply disturbing spy games are being played for, as Martin's pointed out, for missions that will creep into regime change and other projects like smashing up any opposition to the United States' world domination.
Well, the Labour, veteran Labour MP and former Minister Gerald Kaufman also had some words for the discussion and debate, and here's his part, anyway, of his contribution on Wednesday.
If what the government were proposing today would in any way not simply or not totally get rid of Daesh, but weaken them in a significant way so that they would not go on behaving in the abominable fashion that we see, I wouldn't have any difficulty in voting for this motion today. But there is absolutely no evidence of any kind that bombing Daesh, that bombing Raqqa, will result in an upsurge of other people in the region to get rid of them.
Well, that's common sense, isn't it? There are two levels on which this is being... There's people who are saying, well, if this was a viable strategy, I might be inclined to support it. My position, as I've made clear in this programme, is that in actual fact Britain has been intervening in Syria all along by supporting attempt to an armed overthrow of a sovereign state. And that in actual fact it's quite possible that when the historians come to write about this in the future, they will see the conspiracy between Saudi Arabia and the West to overthrow Assad as the source of the hundreds of thousands of deaths and the millions of displaced people. And I think the only thing we can do, having devastated Iraq, devastated Libya and devastated Syria, is to go home and think about our sins, or rather our leaders should do so. Ordinary people are being bamboozled here.
Also, another voice was that of Nadeem Sahawi, who's a Conservative MP.
Daesh are the death that is stretching from the east. When you see them, it is as if you are seeing the angel of death. They're in Raqqa right now. How can I carry on exposing my child to severed heads and hanging bodies on a daily basis? A mother in Raqqa.
Well, this is just emotional blackmail. In actual fact, there were several Tory MPs who voted against, seven Tory MPs who voted against, and eight Liberals and Democrats who voted in favour. But overwhelmingly, all Scottish MPs, bar two, voted against. And I imagine that if we actually analysed the results from Wales, we'd find similar results.
But you're saying blackmail. Actually, I hate to point it out, but Nadeem is actually born in Baghdad. He's Iraqi. Who are you to tell him?
The Iraqi, interesting, so funny you should mention that, because the elected Iraqi government have made it absolutely clear that they don't want any further intervention by Britain and America in Iraq. And they've actually said that they do want the Russians to come into Iraq and help them fight ISIS, but that they don't want the French and the British and the Americans, because they think that they're ISIS's allies. We should have been told that. The MPs ought to know it. But that's the reality, is that the elected Iraqi government is actually quite hostile to our intervention. And in fact, they recognise, because they're on the receiving end, I mean, things like what happened in Paris happen every day in Baghdad. And that's the reality of what's going on. And we've forgotten all about it. It's been going on day in, day out, since Tony Blair made his absurd decision to invade Iraq in 2003.
Yeah, but it's almost as if you haven't noticed that there have been attacks on Paris, Martin.
Well, I have noticed that there have been attacks on Paris. There was an attack the day before in Beirut that killed 40 or 50 Shia, mostly Shia civilians.
And so you think
we didn't even hear about that,
did we? We should sit here twiddling our thumbs, do you think?
No, we shouldn't sit here twiddling our thumbs. I'm in favour of going to war. I'm not a pacifist. But we're going to have to go to war with Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Let's cut off the head of the snake. Let's support those in Saudi Arabia who want to take up arms against that government. Let's do that, shall we? and let's get some car bombs going. Let's be really serious about getting on. We've got to overthrow all of these regimes in the Middle East. The people have got to get into the streets. We've got to arm them up, and then the RAF will come in, as in Libya, and support, give close ground support as these people fight. Is that what we're talking about? No, we're not.
Getting down to Syria specifically, though, what are your thoughts about whether this is going to get a bit of mission creep? A lot of people are saying that they think that's where it's going, towards actual regime change in Syria, which is part of Wesley Clark's announcement just after 9/11. He said that there were seven countries that the US was going to have regime change in, overthrow the governments in 5 years, and Syria and Iran as well are on that list. Do you think we could be going into a mission creep where we start to be part of the moderate Syrian rebels fighting and trying to oust Assad from Damascus? The headlines have been about getting involved in a war in Syria, but what about a war against Syria, and what about a war for Syria?
Well, if you think back to the last time Cameron came to the House of Commons and said, you've got to support us to bomb Syria, he was talking about bombing Assad, supposedly because of his chemical weapons attack at Ghouta on his own people. Although all the evidence since then, I wonder how many Labour MPs have read Seymour Hersh's article in the London Review of Books, which comprehensively proves that the sarin came from Libya, was supplied by MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, and was used as a mechanism to try and trick. So NATO itself was responsible for the death.
It wasn't just Seymour Hersh, it was also Carla Del Ponte at the United Nations.
Indeed,
that was saying
indeed.
That.
And I wonder how many Labour MPs know who Seymour Hersh is, because he was the man who exposed the My Lai massacre. He's got a reputation in US journalistic circles of never getting anything wrong, because his sources are so impeccable. And have they read his article, and do they understand the implications? Now, in actual fact, therefore, what should have happened after it became clear that the Ghouta chemical weapons attack was actually carried out by NATO-allied Turkey, working with the al-Nusra Front and the Saudis, is that we should have declared war on Turkey and Saudi Arabia. But we didn't, did we? Because they're our allies. And I'm in favour of declaring war on Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Maybe Putin should do it. Maybe he will.
Jim from Bristol Stop the War. What about this other side of this mission creep business, where we could actually start to get involved in a war for Syria rather than just in Syria against ISIS?
Well, they've already said that they're in here for the long haul. Now, their original strategy doesn't look very good. The Americans have said they're going to put in ground troops if they need to. It does look like mission creep is on the cards. And there's talk today about salami slicing. Cameron will put in a bombing mission that will prepare the way for his ground troops to go in and will be involved in a massive attack on Syria, as you point out, repeating all the mistakes that we've already had in Iraq and other countries. It really isn't. It's almost beyond belief that this is the fourth war in 14 years that we're expected to support. And that's why we're calling for all these demonstrations. People have got to say this is enough. Britain has better things to do internationally than become a tail following the dog of US imperialism. It's got to say we believe in negotiation, economic support. They should be supporting the refugees in this country. All the migrants should be getting somewhere to live. They should be doing something humanitarian, something we can hold our heads up about, not bombing people.
Well, it's easy to say the migrants should all get somewhere to live, but even British people don't have somewhere to live.
Precisely. It clashes with this ludicrous austerity programme, but these all have got to go if we want to be a country worth living in.
And let's go back to what I was talking about at the top of the hour, which is this amazing plan the neocons had, the project for the new American century. As soon as 9/11 had happened in 2001, this whole idea of these long wars really started to roll out across the world, where the US was basically saying, well, we can invade wherever we want to. And one of the brilliant documentaries done, actually, amazingly enough, by the BBC Panorama at the time was called The War Party, where they went and had a chat to a lot of these neocons. And let's start by having a listen to what James Woolsey said from the CIA.
We will make a lot of people very nervous. And we will hear, for example, the Mubarak regime in Egypt or the Saudi royal family thinking about this idea that these Americans are spreading a democracy in this part of the world. They will say, you make us very nervous. And our response should be good.
going too far?
No. The Iranians and the Syrians are even more nervous than the Saudis and Egyptians at this very moment. Syria is making, you know, and the, you know, the Syrian regime is making comments that they're nervous, that they think that they're next.
So, are the Syrians worried? I went to their embassy to ask whether they took much notice of the neoconservatives. Do they go to those American Enterprise Institute briefings?
Oh, yes, I try to attend almost all their public meetings. Sometimes I find them amusing. Sometimes they are really terrifying in the way they think, the way they would like to shape the world, the way they think they can impose their doctrine and their ideology on everybody else, even if force is needed.
You worried?
No, we are not worried at all. We have our alliances, we have our friends, but I don't think they have any chance whatsoever of translating this agenda into policies.
Well, they, apparently they do now. Martin, that was the deputy ambassador in Washington, the Syrian embassy, and before him you heard James Woolsey from the CIA and Mehrav Wormser from the Hudson Institute. Now this is all coming to pass. There was the Syrians there saying, no, we're not nervous at all.
Well, I think what's actually happened is because of the Russian intervention in Syria, it's quite clear. I mean, the Russians are basically saying, and Assad is basically saying, we can have this war over probably in 2016. If we cut off the supplies to ISIS and we isolate the pockets of the other rebels, many of whom are foreigners, and they say that we're getting good targeting information from on the ground from Syrians, because a lot of the people that are fighting inside Syria are not, in fact, Syrians, and that they're winning the war. Now, at that point, it becomes really embarrassing for the West. They've got to, they had to come up with something, because they failed to convince everybody about the chemical weapons attack. And, of course, it's not just that Assad didn't do it. What people have got to take on board is that NATO did do it. MIT in Turkey were behind that chemical weapons attack which killed hundreds of people. Now, at some point, you've got to say, what should we do? Like Hillary Benn was saying on Wednesday, what should we do? Hundreds of people have been killed by a chemical weapons attack, but it wasn't Assad. It was carried out by Erdogan, who's just been re-elected as president of Turkey. Not that the Kurds are very happy about that. Maybe we should break up his state. Maybe we should take up arms. I'm not a pacifist. Maybe it's about time we started killing these people. What do you think?
Well, let's go back to the post-9/11, immediate post-9/11 era, and 2003, the invasion of Iraq. And here a little clip from a certain prime minister of the time.
The justice of our cause lies in the liberation of the Iraqi people. And to them we say, we will liberate you.
Tony Blair there saying he's going to liberate the Iraqi people, exactly the same, I suppose, as we're hearing now from David Cameron talking about Syria.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the elected Iraqi government has accused Britain of dropping weaponry to ISIS. They've already done it. Not that you've heard about it in the mainstream media here in Britain.
Now let's go back to that same part of that same documentary, Panorama, The War Party, looking at the neocons. And let's have a listen to a chap called Elliot Cohen. He's on the US Defense Policy Board.
Sometimes the word neoconservative is used when what they really would like to say is Jew. People who use that kind of language. And as a Jew, I found it offensive. There are two things that are despicable about it. The first is the imputation of dual loyalties.
Between America and Israel.
Right. And just speaking as somebody whose father served in the United States Army, who served in the United States Army himself, who was the son serving in the United States Army, I find it deeply, deeply offensive and untrue. And the other thing that I find deeply offensive about it is it contains a very old anti-Semitic canard, which is that the Jews, this scattered little people around the world, have these occult powers and are pulling the strings of the naive and duped non-Jews. And it wasn't that long ago that those kinds of beliefs led to hideous things which impinged upon people like me very directly. So yes, I feel very strongly about it.
Well, one might actually say, well, why shouldn't Elliot Cohen have dual loyalties between Israel and the United States, Martin? Because at least Israel is pretty much the only democracy in the Middle East.
apart from if you're a Palestinian. Well, I'd just like to mention Colonel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Sabrowski, former head of the Director of Studies at the US Army War College, and Jewish. He's made it absolutely clear, and people can check this, they can just look it up online, he thinks the Israeli Mossad were behind the 9/11 attacks on the US. He's was a serving US Army officer, a very senior guy, also Jewish, quite straightforward. His loyalties don't lie with Israel. His loyalties lie to the United States, and he's accused Israel of being behind the attacks.
Well, let's hear the final extract from that documentary from Panorama, The War Party. Fascinating insight into the neoconservatives and how all this kind of idea of perpetual war, Middle Eastern wars, and really prepared the groundwork for the invasion of Iraq back in 2003. And here again now from Mayrav Wormser, who's one of the neocons. She is actually from the Hudson Institute. We heard a little clip earlier. Here's another one.
Yes, many of us are Jewish. There's no need to apologize for that. Most of us, all of us, in fact, are pro-Israel. Some of us more fiercely so than others. But we have no problem also criticizing Israel. There is no dual loyalty. The people in the group are Americans, first and foremost, view themselves as American thinkers and as people who are most interested in American policy. We see a tremendous similarity between Israel and America, and Britain for that matter, simply because these are leading democracies. In the case of Israel, it's the only democracy in the Middle East.
As you said there, Jim, the only democracy in the Middle East.
Well, Israel isn't a proper democracy, is it? It's a limited democracy based on religion and ethnicity. It, as Martin pointed out, avoiding the thorny question of the Palestinians and Israeli Arabs who are not treated as equal citizens. So it's a very dubious bit of triumphalism to say Israel's the only democracy, is it?
I mean, also Israel does have an interest in Syria. They've got the Golan Heights they've been occupying since 1967, a very, very long time ago. The Six-Day War, I think it was. Is it, Martin? Is that right? The Six-Day War?
The 73 War.
That the Golan Heights were occupied, and most of the Palestinian territories were taken over in the 67 War. It's never been resolved through the United Nations. They've had many resolutions telling them not to go. But anyway, the most important thing is that they're now drilling for oil, and they're selling oil concessions in the Golan Heights, which is actually part of Syria.
Well, exactly.
It's almost like maybe a state of the USA, Israel, over there.
That's possible. The fact of the matter is, however, in general, that the West is not going to solve this by its present strategy. It's going to just lead to further wars. There's likelihood of actually sparking off, as Martin pointed out, a conflict with Russia, in which case we have started the Third World War. And I think that we're looking at a run-up to an extremely dangerous period, and I think that's why British people, at least half of them, are against any British intervention in this area. As the Iraqi government has said, and the Syrian government, they don't want us there. We've caused enough damage, enough misery, millions of people killed. Can't we just go away and think of something better to do?
Martin, Israel almost seems to have taken a back seat with Syria, even though it's right next door.
Not true. Many people believe that the ISIS is in fact part of Mossad's intelligence operation. The Iraqis claim to have captured an Israeli colonel operating with ISIS inside Iraq. Again, this is not the sort of thing that the mainstream media in the West is reporting, even though it's been reported in Baghdad. And we had the Tory MP from Baghdad earlier talking. Does he know what the press in Baghdad are saying? Al-Baghdadi was seen photographed at least with John McCain inside Syria, and is also widely reputed in Iraq and in Lebanon and other places where serious people read serious newspapers
Americans to have been trained by the Mossad. And, of course, also, there's overwhelming evidence that ISIS fighters and other al-Nusra Front fighters have been taken into Syria for medical treatment and then shipped back into Syria to fight the Assad regime. And some of them were actually attacked by local Druze in the Golan Heights, and then the Israeli army then took on the Druze to protect the terrorists who were being put back inside Syria. So from the Syrian point of view, it's pretty clear that what they're up against is an armed conspiracy of mostly foreigners being supported, armed and trained, by MIT in Turkey, Mossad in Israel, and CIA, MI6, Deuxième Bureau, the French.
And so do you think the Russians who are backing Assad with Assad are going to eventually come to blows with NATO, Britain and the US?
Well, it's interesting. None of the MPs talked about that in that discussion, because if you get to a situation where we are trying to overthrow Assad, that's why the Russians are being very calm about our intervention. They're saying, listen, if you want to go and drop a few bombs on Raqqa, off you go, and we won't do anything about it. But if it comes to a showdown between our forces and Turkey's forces, for example, as we try to close down ISIS's supply lines from Turkey, if the RAF happen to be straying into our airspace at that point, and we at any point can say, you are not to fly in this airspace. The Syrian government and the Russians have taken a very kind of ambiguous stance. What they've said is, we don't want you overflying our airspace, we're not really in favour of you being here, but as long as you're not attacking our positions, we won't do anything. But if they do try and use them to support the moderate rebels, for example, so-called moderate rebels, they will be going directly against the Syrian Arab Army, which has taken 60,000 casualties fighting these terrorists, and they'll also be taking on the Russian Air Force. And I think that the Tornado bombers that the British were deploying earlier in the week are basically junk from 30 years ago. And if they try and take on the modern Russian Air Force, all four of our planes are going to be shot down, and perhaps the pilots captured. And then what?
I'll tell you what, also today we've had German MPs voting for an anti-ISIS military mission, including boots on the ground. The Germans and the Japanese now have said that it's okay for their troops to fight outside. Over the last few years, both countries have voted for that. And the Germans are going to be putting boots on the ground, although they say they're not going to be directly involved in conflict.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the only legal basis for anybody to go into Syria is either a UN Security Council resolution, and what's been passed so far does not.
Well, look, let me just stop you there, because the UN approved Syria resolution. I'm just going to grab the date for that. That's on the 21st of November. Member states were urged to take all necessary measures, but the resolution, let's make it absolutely clear, falls short of invoking Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which authorises military action to restore
peace
and security.
So in other words, that the UN resolution as been agreed by the Russians does not give the right to military action, and the only basis on which you can on a legal basis go into Syria is if you are working directly with the legitimate government of Syria, that is to say the Assad regime. So all of these countries can vote in their parliaments to send the Germans and the Japanese can vote to send their soldiers to fight in Syria.
Yeah, but hang on, Cameron says yes it does, because he's acting in self-defence.
No, he's wrong. There is no basis. I've been reading legal judgments by people who are serious lawyers saying the reason why the Russians agreed that wording for that resolution is because it definitely does not give the right to military intervention.
So why are the Russians saying great and they're not making more of a fuss about it?
Because politically, what the Russians are trying to do is play, all right, well, it'd be unreasonable of us to shoot your planes down, which it would. We're not going to shoot your planes down. And they're also trying to play to get public opinion on their side.
If the Russians are ever going to want to invoke international law, surely they could say what you've done has just broken international law. Well, and they wouldn't have to shoot any planes down.
Well, they've done a deal with NATO, which was broken by the Turks, that they will supply NATO with the full details of what all their planes are doing. And they've done that. And they've said the same to NATO. You tell us where your planes are as well, and we'll make sure that we don't come into any kind of conflict with you. That's the deal. But, of course, the Turks quite deliberately and with American approval shot down a Russian plane. Now, the Russians, rather than overreacting, they're very clever, are just saying, right, we note that. We note what you've just done. We presume that that was agreed with the Americans. We know it was an ambush and it wasn't an accident. But we're not going to do anything for now. As the Aussies say,
You'll keep, mate. You'll keep.
Well, we'll see about that. One of the key elements of all this, of course, is the Israeli involvement with ISIS. We were hearing from John Banks last week about that, for example, helping to train the leader of ISIS. And so let's have a listen now to Stephen Sizer talking about the roots of Israel, for the roots of political Israel, really, that is, roots of Zionism. Now, Stephen Sizer is a reverend in Virginia Water in the Church of England in southwest London. And here he is doing a talk, but he's not allowed to do talks anymore because he's been banned by the church from doing anymore. So let's have a listen to a recording of him talking about Zionism, literally about 6 or 8 months before he was banned from speaking in public by the Church of England.
I discovered that I had inherited a script that viewed the Jews as God's chosen people and the Palestinians were a problem. They were the Philistines. They were the enemy of God's people, and therefore I was nervous about meeting with them. We avoided them. You know, we went to the holy sites, we took our photographs, we read our Bible, we had a religious experience, and we were just a little frustrated that, you know, the Palestinians were in the way of God's will being realized for the Jewish people. And but I went back a second time and a third time and a fourth time, and every time I went back, a little bit more of that romantic vision dissipated, and I began to get to know Palestinian Christians. I'd been brought up to believe all Palestinians were Muslims. The problem was between the Jews and the Muslims. But to discover a Christian, an indigenous Christian Palestinian community, was a revelation. That they'd been there for 2,000 years, that they were suffering as a result of Zionism, and they were suffering largely because the church in the West sided with Israel against the Palestinians. And I began to be troubled by that.
That's Reverend Stephen Sizer. Martin, can you sum up in a nutshell what Zionism is? Because it's a very powerful, in fact, some would say fundamentalist approach that a lot of Israelis have.
Well, Zionism was a product of the sort of late 19th century, early 20th century, and it was probably, you could compare it to Irish republicanism. It was at that time, everybody all over the world was developing nationalistic ideas. And the difference, of course, being that in Ireland they were trying to recapture the historic state of Ireland, which, of course, had never existed apart from as an imaginary goal. And the same was true of Zionism, which was an attempt to create a nationalism for the Jews, revolving around the state of what is now Israel, where most Jews didn't live, which is what made it unique. But you could compare it again with the sort of nationalism of the Afrikaners in South Africa, who call themselves Afrikaners. They're originally from Holland, but they regarded the, you know, Africa as their God-given territory that they were allowed to have. I mean, it looks out of time now. These kind of nationalistic ideas in the 21st century look kind of dated. But Zionism was a product of that era, with all of the positive and negative features that you might imagine.
And what about this idea of Balkanization of the Middle East? Well, that's part of this Yinon plan, isn't it? Yeah, General Oded Yinon.
Yeah, the Yinon plan.
I think it wasn't even in the 1960s, late 60s, he came up with this idea that the best thing to do would be to Balkanize the Middle East and then Israel could expand.
Well, yes, yeah, Israel can expand, but also, of course, if you've got lots of ethnic states surrounding you, the ethnic basis of your own state becomes unremarkable. We've got a Kurdish state over here, we've got a Druze state over here, we've got an Alawite state over here, and we've got a Jewish state over here, and then Israel fits in to the general pattern. But of course, that, you know, in the 19th century, people believed if everybody got their own little state, then everything would be fine. But of course, the problem is that my little state treads on the toes of your little state, as we saw in Yugoslavia, or as we see today in India, or anywhere else in the world. In actual fact, my nationalism is a way of stopping you having your nationalism. So it's actually potentially a recipe for chaos. And I'm afraid that's what we've got.
And Stephen Sizer, the Reverend Stephen Sizer, also sees the Zionism as a kind of form of fundamentalism. We hear lots and lots about Islamic fundamentalism, but very little about Zionist fundamentalism.
there's a very clear, very simple political strategy. The first is, if you believe that the Jews are God's chosen people, you will support the Jews. You will defend Israel. You will target those critical of Israel. So you campaign politically in the White House, the Senate, Congress, Parliament, on behalf of Israel. If you believe that the Jews are God's chosen people and that God gave them the land of the Middle East, then you will support their return. You will fund the return of Jews from Russia, for example, to Israel. If you believe God gave the Jews the West Bank, the Golan, Jordan, then you will encourage the settlement movement. So you have Christian organizations that encourage churches to adopt a settlement, to fund a settlement, a Jewish settlement in the occupied territories. At the moment, the only country in the world that recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel is Israel. No other country in the world recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. There are no embassies in Jerusalem. All the embassies are in Tel Aviv. There is one embassy in Jerusalem, the Christian embassy. And so there is a campaign to get the United States to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. How do you do that? You simply move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And if the U.S. moves its embassy to Jerusalem, everyone else will do the same. And de facto, Jerusalem becomes capital. So there are Christian organizations lobbying Congress to move the embassy to Jerusalem. The legislation has been passed on at least three occasions. The funding has been allocated. The building has been identified. But three successive presidents have refused to sign the legislation. So it's failed. Zionist lobby, the religious Zionist lobby, wants to see the temple rebuilt. The problem is the Haram al-Sharif, the Dome of the Rock, is in the way. And so you find Christian groups campaigning with Jewish settlers to destroy the Dome of the Rock in order to rebuild the Jewish temple. So in its extreme form, Christian Zionism is very provocative. It is apocalyptic. It is very fundamentalist in a military sense, very little different to ISIS or Al-Qaeda in terms of what it's prepared to support.
Well, that's obviously about Christian Zionists rather than Zionists as such. But paradoxically enough, of course, there is a massive alliance emerging between Saudi Arabia, the biggest fundamentalist Muslim state in the world, and Israel, which has got a fundamentalist religious orientation to its government, to crush secular states like Syria and balkanize them upon religious and ethnic lines, as we're seeing. And the paradoxes of this are just getting more and more ridiculous, but I think it's absolutely clear that is what's developing.
Another thing, Stephen Sizer, a final clip from him now, talks about is this kind of idea of doom porn, that a lot of them are talking about doom and gloom over there, that is, there's going to be some sort of apocalyptic clash between Islam and the Jews.
In every generation, for hundreds if not thousands of years, there have been people who held to an apocalyptic theology. So it's not something new, that extremism that believes that they will bring about God's will through violence or through force is sadly an aberration in all three monotheistic faiths. One of the leading Jewish settlers, Zionists, Gershon Salomon, says, we must have a war. The Messiah will not come by himself. We must bring him by fighting. Now, that was the position of the Zealots in the first century. They believed that as they fought, God would vindicate them. It's not that dissimilar to many of the fundamentalist groups in the Middle East today. They believe God is on their side rather than asking, am I on God's side? Am I following his revealed will in the scriptures, or am I using God as an excuse to further my political aims?
Using God as an excuse to further my political aims sounds a little bit like ISIS, doesn't it?
It does, and of course, ISIS in many ways is a creation of Orientalist minds within the Western intelligence services. So people can look it up. ISIS have got a monthly magazine which has lots of lovely colour pictures. It's basically it's like
I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll put a link
Vogue,
to it. Martin, we'll put a link to it on the show page at thisweek.org.uk because it is. It's quite an astounding magazine.
Yes, and it's clearly been written by US PR professionals in English.
There is a material base to all this, surely. The Western capitalism faces massive crisis. It's very hard for them to get out of it. Look at Japan. It's been in recession for, like, decades. So millenarianism, let's have a cataclysm, fits in with Western capitalism's need to clear the air. Let's have a massive war. This is extremely disturbing, though, because this... We know what the Second World War was like, but the Third World War is unimaginably bad. And I think we're dealing with lunacy, really. And what Stop the War is asking is that people, the British public, aren't mad. That enough people have regained logic and sanity to call their rulers to question and say, do you really want this cataclysm? And I think that's what we're told, why we're asking people to come to London next, not this Saturday coming, but the Saturday after.
Martin, what about we are now, I go back to this point, we are now actually in Syria fighting where the Russians are fighting too. It's quite feasible that we could disagree about things.
Well, I think I'm reasonably calm about the situation at the minute because they don't really dare to take on the Syrian Arab Army, who have actually got very good fighting in the last 4 years, and the Russian Air Force. If they do attempt to try and overthrow Assad or partition Syria, then it'll get to the point where the RAF will have to take on the Russian Air Force. The RAF will lose.
Very briefly, San Bernardino shootings, what do we know? Well, again, it looks as if the people are dead, Martin, the people who did it, so no trials.
Well, these kind of shocking events are being used, in my view, they're Gladio-style events to try and scare the population to accept more loss of liberties.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest in the first hour for St George West Labour, Ron Stone. Our sister show Dialect's been dropped from the BCFM schedule by the chair and the manager, but it's still available as a podcast. You can hear last week's special on the withdrawal of funding from St Paul's Carnival, from Carnival director Cleo Lake, also the Medieval Knights Templar, and the Merchant Venturers, St Paul poet Lawrence Hu, challenges Bristol's official history. You can download this podcast and read those links at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Listening to
Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. James G. Anderson, Professor of Atmospheric Chemistry at Harvard. This precious interview on climate change was hard to find among millions of YouTube entries. The link came to me in a post from Chicago. The film shows a young, unidentified Chinese student across the desk from Professor Anderson, getting answers to his well-prepared questions. Professor James Anderson did some of the research resolving the mystery of which industrial chemicals destroyed the ozone layer over Antarctica. The urgent need to deal with deadly UV radiation led to the signing of the Montreal Protocol in 1989. Now, almost 30 years later, Anderson is doing ozone research again, this time over the continental U.S. Harvard Magazine said in 2012 that atmospheric chemists report a serious and wholly unexpected risk of ozone loss over the United States in summer. And Anderson believes that climate change is a factor in this new phenomenon. He points to increasingly frequent thunderstorms that are injecting ozone-destroying water vapors into the stratosphere. Climate change is still experienced as a local event, often different depending on where you live and work. When the student began the interview by asking Anderson how he defines climate change, he got an intriguing and complex answer. The storms and heat or cold that we experience where we live are really caused by the reorganization of global climate structures. And what happens in the polar regions or the global air and ocean currents has local effects. Professor James G. Anderson.
I think the most important way to look at climate change is to look at the structure that defines the overall dynamics of the atmosphere and how that couples into a combination of weather, severe storms, changes in the ice structures, shifts in the temperature difference between the tropics and the polar regions. So the climate is set up as a feedback structure that is highly coupled, so that changes in one part, for example, loss of Arctic ice, cascades into a whole array of different fundamental changes in the structure of climate. For example, right now the current climate structure is built around a very cold polar region and a very warm tropics. And because of that, we have a very, very dry stratosphere. And that's a unique climate structure. If we lose Arctic ice, and the temperature difference starts to decrease between the tropics and the polar regions, the overturning structure of the atmosphere will relax and water will enter the stratosphere. We'll have a very warm, very wet stratosphere. And the result of that is that the temperature difference between the equator and the pole will essentially vanish. And that completely changes the way the climate structure of the Earth behaves. But more than that, with a moist stratosphere, ozone is removed from the stratosphere because we have chlorine and bromine that are present there because of CFC release. And so that's going to be profoundly damaging to life on the surface, not just human beings, but also all of our staple crops that provide food for the population, all of that will collapse. So I view climate as an issue of the structure, not simply a matter of global warming. I think the term global warming is a very inappropriate description. It carries with it the connotation of very slow change and the fact that we can think things over. But instead of that, climate is a series of irreversible steps. The time constant for change is set by these feedbacks. So it's a very delicate, very intricate structure that we've been bequeathed by the optimal relationship between the cold polar region and the warm tropics.
In terms of the climate change, we've always had these debates, right, regarding if climate change is caused by humans or is it caused by nature. But most people think the scientific consensus stands on that global warming and climate change is caused by humans. Where do you stand on this matter?
Well, when you look at the changes in climate over the past millions of years, it's very evident that there were mechanisms in place that caused those natural changes, whether it was a volcanic emission of CO2, whether it was the removal of CO2 from the atmosphere by the carbonate silicate reactions, or whether it was the Earth's orbit eccentricity and the tilt of the Earth in combination that carried us in and out of glacial periods for the past 2.5 million years. When you look at these patterns, they are all overwhelmed by increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's a very simple calculation. And so the idea that what we've seen recently is a natural process decoupled from human activity is simply false. Humans are overwhelmingly responsible for causing the forcing of the climate that's now taking place that slowly manifests itself in average global temperature change, but dramatically emphasizes the point that the delicacy of the climate structure revolves first around the removal of ice structures, particularly in the Arctic. And so there's no question that human beings are fundamentally responsible for the current changes in the climate.
Do you think climate change is drastically affecting you?
Well, it's drastically affecting me in that I study it, and my concern grows year by year as I study the system more and more carefully and study the feedbacks that lead to tipping points, which are irreversible changes. So it has a huge impact on my life. With respect to my analysis of personal impacts by climate change alone, part of our research focuses on the intensity and frequency of severe storms in the high plains of the United States in the summer. These are tornadoes, hail storms that we tend to take for granted in this country, but are in fact unique worldwide. And the reason that these storms are important, first of all, is of course they are profoundly destructive to human life and human property. But more importantly, they're capable of injecting water directly into the stratosphere over the United States in the summer. And we diagnosed the chemistry over the Antarctic and the Arctic in the winter that led to the Antarctic ozone hole and then comparable large removal of ozone over the Arctic in the late winter. And diagnosing that chemistry, we realized that it's exactly the same chemistry that's triggered by storms injecting water vapor into the stratosphere, except in this case it's over the United States in the summer rather than the polar regions in the winter. So absolutely. Now of course the jet stream position is a sensitive function of the temperature difference between the tropics and the polar regions, and that jet stream position of course brought one of the largest snowfalls to New England. So yeah, I shoveled out day after day after day, and if we had a disciplined temperature structure between the tropics and polar regions, the meandering of that jet stream would not have occurred the way it did. Yes. Of course, based on what I've said so far, the term global warming is an inappropriate term to describe climate change. And I think one of the reasons that the entire campaign around climate change has been ineffective was that, and scientists are at fault for this, the term global warming was used, and it carries with it no political imperative, because many people want their backyard to be warmer. They're moving out of New England and the northern Midwest and moving south. So it has no political impetus behind it, and it has this connotation of slow change. So if I compare the resources going into describing climate change and its irreversible consequences versus the money that's going in from the fossil fuel industry distributing misinformation about this subject, there's no parity between those two. Massively more money is being spent on misinformation from the fossil fuel industry that is being spent on representing the facts related to climate change. Now, I also hold universities culpable because they're not educating their undergraduates on the fundamentals of what's actually occurring in the climate energy axis. And until universities step up and take responsibility for modern curricula that prepare their graduates to take a proactive role in society, it's going to be very difficult to make political progress, because the money invested in by the fossil fuel industry and misinformation largely overwhelms efforts to try to explain this to the public.
Do you think climate change is now more to a political issue or a scientific issue? Because these days we see that it has shifted a lot to politics, because the Democrats and Republicans are asked to take sides on whether they support climate change or they shouldn't.
Well, it's overwhelmingly an issue of political will, but you're absolutely correct in bringing in three elements of this: politics, science, and economics. And as the situation is examined more and more carefully, it's pretty clear that economics is switching strongly over for renewable energy, because, to put it bluntly, middle-aged and older people are making money off of fossil fuels, and that blocks opportunity for young people to engage in innovation, creativity, and economic enterprise globally. But the investment in renewables and the job opportunities presented by renewable energy vastly overwhelm the job opportunities in fossil fuels. And in fact, you can see it occurring. There are major investments by companies, Google, for example, is just one, but many others, investing in renewable energy and renewable energy infrastructure. And the country that wins this battle on innovation and development of renewable energy sources, wind, solar, geothermal, that become economically competitive worldwide, will be the country or countries that win the economic battle, because there's vastly greater opportunity and capability for the next generation embedded in the renewable energy sector than there is in fossil fuels. Fossil fuels is a dead industry. It doesn't generate jobs anything close to the number of the potential within the renewable energy industry.
Are you familiar with the Kyoto Protocol?
Oh, yes.
Do you think it would actually be beneficial for the U.S. if it actually joined the Kyoto Protocol, because it did withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol, right?
Right. Well, starting with another protocol, we did the key research over the Antarctic demonstrating that COCs destroyed ozone, in particular the chlorine and bromine radicals. And so we were involved in the public policy debates around the Montreal Protocol, which then became an international agreement banning CFCs. So I've watched the evolution of these protocols very carefully. The Kyoto Protocol had on its side the advantage that it brought nations together to try to execute an international agreement on fossil fuels. Now, it failed in many ways. One of them was that it probably didn't recognize the rapid ascent of the Asian economic structure. And secondly, you can watch very carefully to see whether there'll be any serious negotiation over carbon release, namely CO2 and methane, by whether nations actually have a highly unequivocal budget of their own carbon release and take-up, because all of these countries are very, very different. The United States, for example, because it was an agricultural endeavor on the eastern end of the United States in the 19th and early 20th century, it actually was taking up quite a bit of carbon because it was regrowing these forests that were cleared for farming. But every nation is different, and every nation has to have a very detailed definition of the flux of carbon into and out of its own territory. So the Kyoto Protocol didn't have that basic information in place, so it couldn't in any way be an effective international governance. On the other hand, it opened the debate about nations signing on to carbon control. So from that point of view, it was a landmark event. It just had some fatal flaws in it, which could have been repaired in time had countries stepped in to take advantage of it. And that gets back to the fundamental point that until China, the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and Korea, and perhaps Brazil, sign on to a carbon control agreement, it won't take place. So, you know, meetings involving 190 nations are simply never going to solve the problem. It has to be solved with China and the United States signing an agreement, having clear controls, and then Western Europe, Korea, and Japan signing on to those agreements.
There has been theories regarding why climate change has happened. For example, like that there's a change in the ozone layer. Do you think that it's really a big factor, the change in the ozone layer, in terms of how the climate is changing?
No, the ozone layer doesn't control climate. Climate controls the ozone layer. It works the other way around. Ozone controls this lethal small segment of the spectrum, the ultraviolet spectrum, which just barely penetrates the stratospheric ozone, because ozone is the only molecule that removes ultraviolet photons between 200 and 300 nanometers, which is exactly where DNA absorbs ultraviolet photons. And an ultraviolet photon absorbed by DNA breaks the base pair across the double helix and it initiates cancer. So ozone is extremely rare. If you compress the total ozone column from the stratosphere to the floor of this office, it would only be an eighth of an inch thick. So tiny, tiny amount of ozone. It has dominant control, total control over that crucial segment of the ultraviolet spectrum that kills organisms on the surface and initiates cancer. But ozone doesn't control the climate. On the other hand, climate intimately controls ozone, because climate controls the amount of water going into the stratosphere, and the amount of water in the stratosphere decidedly controls the ozone concentration.
There has been a lot of speculations regarding how humans try to control greenhouse gases from getting too bad. Why do you think humans have failed to actually like curb the greenhouse gases, to control them?
Oh, because the entire economic infrastructure is built on the back of cheap energy, namely fossil fuels. And fossil fuels are abundant, they're very inexpensive, and yet they are responsible for 85% of all primary energy generation worldwide. So we built fossil fuels into our economic structure. However, I think Mother Nature is sitting back and watching this process, saying, well, I gave humans the intelligence to know how to extract an amount of fossil fuels to initiate the Industrial Revolution, but I've also given human beings 10,000 times as much energy per unit time from the sun as is required to sustain all of human endeavor. So So now I'm going to see whether humans are smart enough to convert from fossil fuel to renewable energy, because I've given them all the renewable energy they could possibly hope for. And so it's going to be a question of political will and fundamental intelligence about whether we can break the back of a needless economic infrastructure based on fossil fuels that not only causes climate change, but the release of nitrate, sulfate, heavy metal from coal combustion in particular is extremely toxic. I mean, look at China today, look at the United States 30 years ago. Nitrate sulfate emission is a catastrophic contribution to acidity in the atmosphere and damages lakes, human lungs, and then mercury that's interstitial to coal is very damaging to the human nervous system. So everything is wrong with burning fossil fuels. Everything is correct in converting photons from the sun to electricity. And that leaves you with only 7% of the requirement for liquid fuels. And we can create all the liquid fuel we need for aviation from biomass. So nature set this whole system up ideally for us. Question is, are we smart enough to figure this out?
Do you think your experiences working here and around the Boston area has affected how you think about climate change?
Well, the immediate answer to that question is that I'm in the chemistry, chemical biology department, earth and planetary sciences department, and the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences at Harvard. So this is a profoundly rich mixture of colleagues who understand these issues end to end. And then there's the Harvard University Center for the Environment that couples science into the Kennedy School, Law School, Business School, Medical School, School of Public Health. And the way in which that links into economics and politics and joins science, economics, and politics together is a really unique opportunity. So there's that aspect to it. And then when you live on the coast, you realize that sea level rise, which is inexorably coming from the melting of glacial systems, particularly in Greenland and the West Antarctic ice shelf, you realize how vulnerable coastal cities are. And Harvard is investing billions of dollars to build a new campus just across the Charles River that's only a meter and a half above sea level. Well, the nominal forecast for sea level rise by the end of the century, only a quarter of the length of time Harvard has been a university, is somewhere between 2 and 3 meters with a tail running out to 6 to 7 meters. So immediately building in Alston raises the question, well, what's going to happen when sea level rises and those buildings start to go underwater? So yeah, Boston is a fantastic place to study climate.
Many scientists have tried to find a way to measure the change in climate change, but one of the most notable, I think, is that they suggested to try to use an average global temperature to measure the change. Do you think this is a correct way to measure?
No, I think it's the least articulate way of studying what's occurring, because when you look at global mean temperature, what the dominant control over global mean temperature involves the inflow of heat into the ocean and into the land mass and into the ice systems. Well, the oceans cover 70% of the area of the Earth, and they have an average depth of 3,500 meters, and they have massive heat capacity, the oceans, that is. So a lot of heat can pour into the ocean before there's any measurable temperature change. The thing you have to look at is the measure of the flow of heat into, for example, the ice structures, the cryospheric system. And you realize the tiny, tiny amount of inflow of heat can completely destroy the ice systems, because the heat of fusion of water is so small that all of these ice systems are profoundly delicate. And so defining this in terms of the increase in global mean temperature is the worst way to describe the severity of the problem.
What do you think is the best thing to do to prevent global warming for now?
Well, they're actually, when you look at the numbers on the rate of onset of for example, the loss of ice systems in the Arctic, and you look at the paleo record, where you track the relationship between ice systems, global climate structure, temperature, and carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere from, say, the Eocene 40 million years ago, you come to the very immediate quantitative conclusion that three things are going to be necessary. We have to terminate adding more CO2 to the atmosphere, because we're now at 400 parts per million of CO2, but we have to add another 90 parts per million from the combination of methane, N2O, and CFCs. So we're at almost 500 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. At 500 parts per million of CO2, the paleo record shows that there are no ice structures in the northern hemisphere at that level. And when you destroy the ice structures in the northern hemisphere, you destroy the temperature difference between the equator and the pole that drives the fundamental climate structure. So that tells you immediately that you have to do three things. You have to stop adding CO2 to the atmosphere and methane and N2O immediately. You have to draw CO2 back down below 300 parts per million to reach a stable state. And then you have to cool the planet to reform those ice structures. And you have to do that very, very gently. But all three of those are required. And that's just an unfortunate fact.
You heard an interview with Harvard Professor of Atmospheric Chemistry, James G. Anderson, posted on YouTube on July 21st, 2015. The young man who is seen across from Anderson's desk on the video left himself unidentified. In his notes for the film, he writes that climate change is truly one of the most pressing matters, and that we should be worried. I thank him for having done the interview and introduced a whole rarely covered aspect of atmospheric chemistry into the debate. That may be of huge importance as geoengineering projects are being discussed. They, admittedly, may have destructive effects on the ozone layer. Please take this information to heart. I'm posting a link to the full 36-minute interview on YouTube on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Thanks to Dale Lehman from WZRD Radio Chicago for sharing this link. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this program, we visit Brussels, Belgium, to discuss the effects of the November 13, 2015, Islamic extremist terrorist attacks in Paris, France. Our guest is Jean-Jacques Jesper, who recently retired as the anchor for the television news broadcast aired nightly in French on the Belgian National Television Network. While the terrorist attacks occurred in Paris, France, investigations led authorities to neighboring Belgium in search for the suspects causing a state of emergency in the country's capital city, Brussels. Currently, Jean-Jacques Jesper is a journalism professor and a member of the Belgian Journalists' Committee on Human Rights. Jean-Jacques Jesper and I first met here in Mendocino County in 1977 when he was the leader of a television news magazine team reporting on California. When Jean-Jacques Jesper and I visited by phone from his home in Brussels on November 28, 2015, we began when I asked him to describe what occurred and what the Belgian people's reactions were to the November 13th terrorist attacks in Paris and the lockdown in Brussels.
Well, the French police found out that some of the people involved in that bombing, involved in that killing in Paris, were coming from Brussels, from Molenbeek. For this reason, the Belgian police started to search for these people all over the city. They needed more police, more people for these searchings. So they decided to establish sort of a lockdown. It meant that cinemas, theater, concert halls, meetings, demonstrations, and so on were closed or forbidden. We've seen many soldiers, many military, many policemen in the streets to protect schools and metro stations, public houses, and so on. For 2 days, the schools, the metro, the sports stadium were closed. Now it's finished, but 2 days ago they decided to close every place where people could gather. But people here think that it was not useful to act that way. It was excessive, that it was too much. Because when you are looking for people, well, you're looking for criminals. It's not useful to impose that sort of lockdown to the people.
How long did the lockdown last?
Well, it's a very strange situation. You have four different levels of urgency decided by the government. When the level is two, for instance, they just have you just have some policemen in front of some buildings. And when the level is three, military are coming in the streets and are disposed in front of other buildings. And in level four, these gatherings, the meetings and so on are forbidden, are cancelled. The cinema, the theater, the meeting halls and so on are closed. Even the schools and the metro lines, because they are underground, are closed. But it was not very coherent because, for instance, the railway that is also underground was not closed. The trains were passing through the tunnels, but the metro was closed for the same reason. It's a very strange situation, not very rational, not very coherent, and everybody's asking why did they decide that and why did they decide that it's not necessary anymore, because nothing has changed. The people that they were searching are not found. They haven't found anyone. So they have arrested two or three people, but these people are not the major persons involved in the killings.
What does the Belgian government say to the population with regard to the lockdown and their inability to find the criminals that they suspect are there?
It's not only the fact that they're looking for criminals. There was, according to the government, there was a threat of another killing in Brussels. They say that they had information about a project of a killing, a massive killing in Brussels, in which 10 different persons would be involved. The Minister of Foreign Affairs declared that, in fact, in an interview with an American network, which was not broadcasted in Belgium, but now with internet, everyone can watch it. So it was a big buzz, a big fuzz in Belgium when people heard that declaration of the minister. So now we know that there was a threat, but this threat has not disappeared. So why do the government decide now that it's finished and that everything can be normal? it's very strange.
What is the answer to that question? Why did the government decide that it's finished?
They don't really answer the question. They just say that investigations have been made and that they have arrested a few people, and that's enough from their point of view to decide to lift the lockdown.
From your perspective as a journalist, I remember many years ago you were the person who was live on French television every evening sharing the news.
That's it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you think was approved or what was beneficial by this 10-day lockdown?
Of course, everything has to remain secret if you want to help the police to do its job. So they don't give many information from some informations that have been found by journalists or reporters. It appears that the police have discovered some seats, some places where these terrorists could have met. So maybe the inquiries, the investigations have succeeded in some way, and that's the reason why they have decided to go back to the normal situation. But nobody knows.
Let's go back into history, in the short run and from a longer perspective, about the consequences, as you call it, that Belgium and France are now paying as a result of the choices that your governments made.
I think it's mainly France that has to pay for these choices, because France has decided to send airplanes to Syria and to export war in that country and to fight against ISIS, Daesh. And of course, it's difficult to imagine that if you fight an enemy, this enemy won't fight back. So that was the answer. But the people who have made these killings and who are coming from Belgium, from Brussels, from Molenbeek, are coming from a neighborhood where there is 40% of unemployment, where there is a majority of people coming from Northern Africa, and there is a lot of drugs, prostitution, teenager gangs, and so on. It has nothing to do with religion. It's just the way they have found to find a sense to their lives. And because most of them have been in prison, have been in jail for several times, and it's there in prisons that they have met people who have radicalized them and who have drafted them for the war, for the jihad.
What do you believe is the goal of the people who are involved in the jihad?
I think it's a political goal. From the beginning, the founders of the ISIS, of the jihad groups in Syria and Iraq, the founder was a prisoner in Guantanamo, and people say that he has been involved with the CIA and that he was helped by the Israelis' secret services, by the Saudi secret services, by the Qatari secret services, Kuwaiti, and even the CIA to set up this group in order to fight against the influence of Iran in the region, in order to fight against the Syrian government that was a threat to Israel, and so on. So it has started in a very strange context. I think now the goal of the ISIS is to establish an Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. I don't think they are getting very good for them. It's difficult, and they will lose their fight, I think. So they are exporting the fight in Europe.
But that creates a whole new face, a whole new war front of technological war, as opposed to
in order to create panic and to create to disturb the situation in Europe. But that's not very efficient from their point of view. I think it will give just bad results.
What do you mean, bad results?
I mean, if they were really powerful, they won't do that. It's a proof of weakness. They are weaker and weaker in their fight in Syria, and so they export their fighting to Europe just to impress the world opinion and so on. But I think they are going to lose.
But you've also indicated that the current activities are part of a lasting effect of the agreement between France and Britain in 1920 about the partition of the latter part of the Ottoman Empire.
Yes, if you want to look at history, you can say that it is a consequence of, for instance, the Sykes-Picot agreements in 1920, when the partition of the Ottoman Empire was decided between Britain and France, and the frontier, the border between Syria and Iraq was designed, was drawn just like that on the map without asking anyone what the people would like to. So it divided the Arabs, it divided the Muslims, and so on. And since then, there has always been problems in that part of the world, and the Western. The Europeans, the Britons, the French have always been involved in the wars in that part of the of Asia of Middle East. So I think this part of the world has to be left in peace, and I think the best solution would to leave the local people find the solution between themselves without interfering.
Some would argue that that would deprive the countries of oil, Europe and North America in particular.
I think the problem is not so. It has been a very deep problem maybe 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, but now the main providers of oil in Europe are, for instance, Russians, Norway, Netherlands, Algeria. The Middle East is less important from this point of view.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Jean-Jacques Jesper, a retired professor of journalism and former anchor of the nightly news broadcast in French on the Belgian National Television Network. We're discussing the effects in Belgium of the terrorist bombings in Paris in November 2015. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Let's talk about Belgium. Mm-hmm. How would you describe the reactions of the Belgian people? And by that, I mean the ones who are not foreigners to Belgium or of multiple origins, their reaction to the new immigrants and perhaps to the refugees that may be coming from other uh-huh. parts of the world?
Well, of course, these events in Syria have brought many people to Europe. About 400,000 people this year are coming from Syria or Iraq because of the war there. And, of course, that increases the number of refugees we have to accept here. But in the last months, there have been a lot of people coming, 20,000. The media say that it's an important number, but in fact, 10 years ago, we've already had a large number of refugees coming from other parts of the world, and during the war in Yugoslavia, there were also a lot of refugees coming. So it's not a special situation. We're used to it. We're used to that. So the problem is to house these people, of course. There have been some negative reactions in some parts of the country, but it's not very important. Of course, the extreme rights parties are trying to use the situation to excite the people, but it doesn't work very well. You have more people who are organizing themselves to welcome the refugees, to find clothes or food or lodgings for the refugees. So it's dividing the society on one side, but on the other side, it's creating a wave of solidarity, and that's quite interesting. The Flemish Nationalist Party, the NVA, is quite conservative and quite right-wing, and they say that among refugees, maybe there are terrorists hiding. But I don't think that people are believing in that kind of speech, because we can see that the refugees coming here are not terrorists. They just have paid a lot of money to cross the sea. They have maybe lost members of their family. They are completely lost, and maybe 99.99 of them are percent of them are just persons in looking for a better situation. That's all.
The community of Molenbeek in Brussels. Can you describe what is happening there from your perspective?
Well, it's one of the 19 cities included in the region of Brussels, in the Brussels capital city. It's called Molenbeek. It's on the east side of the city, and it is in fact divided in two parts. The eastern part is a very popular part where people are rather poor, and the western part is a rich part where modern buildings are have been built, where you can find parks, trees, gardens, and so on. But on the east, the people are rather poor. There is a lot of unemployed, almost 40% of unemployment. There is a lot of people coming from Morocco, from northern Africa. Maybe 70% of the people are coming from Morocco, although they are Belgian. They have a Belgian passport, and many of them are the grandchildren of the people who came here to work in the 60s, in the late 60s. There are problems of discrimination. For instance, if your name is Mohammed or Ali, you have, of course, less chance to find a job than if your name is Mark or Paul. Therefore, the people there are sometimes a little anger, and they find that the society where they are living in is not integrating them, is not giving them good chances to succeed in life. And that's maybe the reason why some of these young people are so angry and can be seduced by radical discourse, by radical propositions.
What do you see as the future of those circumstances that you describe?
On one hand, you have to go to some mosques where radical discourse or radical speeches are held, and you have to look after some imams that are coming from Saudi Arabia or the Emirates, and who don't even speak French and who spread hate and anti-Semitism, for instance, in their speeches, in their preaches, and that's one side of the problem. But on the other side, many politicians are considering now that there has to be another politic, another way of acting, employment, jobs, and so on. And I think there will be change in this little city of Molenbeek in the future. But when, I don't know.
By and large, you sound optimistic about the situation in your country and in Europe in general.
Well, Belgians have always been optimistic because they've always lived in very strange situation. Since 1830, Belgium has always been an occupied country. The power was abroad. The people in charge of the power were foreigners. So we're used to resist and wait for better days.
Well, Jean-Jacques Jasper, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. But before we close, I'd like to ask about you. In your long career, spanning 40 years as a journalist with prior training in the law, can you tell us about an aha or eureka moment that changed your life or gave you a new path to follow?
Well, it's connected with the moment we met in 1977 in California, and I was there for a magazine, and I have met so many interesting people there that it has changed my point of view about life. The people I met, the places I was visiting, the situations I was reporting about have really changed my mind.
What changes did they bring about?
It was such a bright way of thinking, and it was like discovering freedom. Of course, the fact that I had the chance to stay for a while, to stay for about 1 month and a half, that was wonderful. It's the only moment in my career when I had the occasion to stay such a long time in a foreign country, and that was very important to me.
And Jean-Jacques Jesper, what would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
Well, I'm retired now, but since I'm retired, I'm still very active. I'm a member of the Human Rights Committee here in Brussels, in Belgium. I'm also a member of the Press Council, and I'm still teaching at the university. And what I want to do is to go on as long as it is possible. Maybe I will die in a few years, but I don't mind, since I can imagine that I'm useful to something and that I'm a member, an active member of the society.
And finally, is there a book that you can recommend to our listeners?
I just read one by Ken Follett, the British writer. It's called The Century. The series is called The Century, and the last part is called Edge of Eternity.
Well, Jean-Jacques Jesper, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you to you, and it's a real pleasure.
Jean-Jacques Jesper recently retired as the anchor for the television news broadcast every evening in French on the Belgian National Television Network. Currently, he is a part-time journalism professor, a member of the Belgian Journalists' Committee on Human Rights, and along with other journalists, critiques the news. He and I have been friends since 1977 when we met here in Mendocino County, California. The books Jean-Jacques Jesper recommends are the three-volume series called The Century Trilogy by Ken LaFollette. This program was recorded on November 28, 2015. Radio Curious has over 500 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new programs published weekly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. We appreciate your thoughts, ideas, and comments about our programs and enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541, and the address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. Christina Onnested is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Our Renewable Future, Richard Heinberg, How to Get There from Here. This is the second part of a one-hour speech. Richard Heinberg's books and films on energy and his ongoing collaborations with his colleagues at the Post-Carbon Institute made him an inspiration for the international localization and transition town movements. In part one of this program, he gave an analysis of fossil fuel supply, climate risk, and the real power behind fracking in the U.S. Here now is his three-level plan for the transition to renewable energy. He's touching on food production, transportation, housing, manufacturing, steel and cement construction, mining, the internet, and much more, all in 24 minutes. He calls this the economic transformation for the remainder of our lives. Richard Heinberg.
This energy transition is going to be a big deal. And if we want to accomplish it successfully, it's going to be good for us to think of it in terms of levels of difficulty. I'm not going to call it stages because stages would imply, well, we're going to do stage one, then we're going to finish that and go to stage two, and so on. We're actually going to have to start with all of these things at the same time, but it's good to have some sense of the low-hanging fruit, right? What we can do right away that won't take so long. Just about everybody agrees that where we should start with the energy transition is coal. Basically, legislating coal out of existence. Replacing all of our coal power plants with solar, wind, geothermal, what have you. That's kind of the no-brainer. Coal, obviously, is the worst climate offender. And we could do this. Okay. How about home heating? In this part of the country, most of us are using natural gas. In the eastern part of the U.S., a lot of folks are heating with oil. Obviously, all of that is fossil fuels. How to do it with electricity? Well, electric heaters, the kinds of space heaters most of us are familiar with, are extremely energy inefficient. But there are better options. By the way, the strategy of electrifying more of our energy use has got to be front and center with our overall strategy for the energy transition. Remember, most of our renewable sources of energy produce electricity directly. So we have to take advantage of that bonus that we're getting wherever we possibly can by using energy in the form of electricity. Wherever it's possible. So in terms of heating our homes, how about air source heat pumps? They're much more energy efficient than electric space heaters or baseboard heaters or what have you. Millions of these could be put in service across the U.S. Instantly, we could do away with a lot of our reliance on natural gas or oil. Now, obviously, somebody's got to pay for all that. So each household, presumably, would have to pony up a few thousand dollars. We're talking roughly $3,000 or $4,000 to install one of these things. So the energy transition is not going to be free. Same thing with transportation. We could drive electric cars. Electric cars are on the market. But the average person does not buy a new car every year. This is a partial solution, but it's something that is possible. It is gaining momentum. More electric cars are coming on the market every year. But if we get out of our cars and share transportation or walk or ride bicycles, that's immediately cheaper and more efficient, obviously much better. How about cooking? Again, electrify everything we possibly can. How about our food system? Our food system is a huge energy user, and we're going to have to transform our food system in pretty profound ways, because currently our food system depends a lot on oil for inputs like transporting, you know, fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides to the farm. The fertilizers are mostly made from natural gas. The pesticides and herbicides are mostly made from oil or oil byproducts. So all of that has got to change. Organic agriculture is our option there. So we need basically to transition our whole food system to one that is not dependent on these fossil fuel inputs, and it's also much more localized. So instead of shipping our foods for, you know, average of 1,500 miles, we're growing more of our food locally and reducing processing and packaging, because this is actually a surprisingly large contributor to the energy footprint of our food. Okay, that's the easy stuff. And if we did all of this easy stuff, we could probably reduce our reliance on fossil fuels by, say, let's say roughly 40%. It's really impossible to total it up and get to an exact number, but let's say 40%. So what's in the next swath here of the harder stuff? Well, here we're talking about not just coal, but also natural gas. Now, why is that going to be harder than coal? Because right now we use natural gas peaking plants in order to buffer the intermittency of solar and wind. If suddenly, you know, you don't have the wind power or the solar power, but you have electricity demand, you fire up the natural gas peaking plant. And that's actually going to be a more important strategy as solar and wind make up a larger and larger proportion of our total electricity supply. But if we want to get natural gas out of the picture, because it's still a fossil fuel, what do we do in that case? Well, we're going to need energy storage. Batteries are actually an inherently inefficient way of storing electricity. Now, everyone's gotten excited in the last year or so about the Tesla batteries and some improvements in battery storage efficiency and cost and so on. Yeah, batteries are getting better, but if you look at the theoretical maximum efficiency of chemical storage of electricity, it's still way below other options for energy storage. Our most efficient option from the standpoint of cost is storing electricity in reservoirs. You know, just pump water uphill when you have excess electricity into reservoirs and let it flow back downhill through turbines. But we don't have enough reservoirs. You know, you have to have the right topography in order to make optimum use of that energy storage. So, you know, right now, we really don't have the possibility of storing enough energy for long enough to get rid of natural gas. In the transport sector, we talked about electric cars, but cars are inherently energy inefficient. I mean, in most cases, with an automobile, you're talking about a couple of tons of metal and glass and plastic and rubber that you have to move around in order to transport one human being, right? That's inherently very inefficient. So there, we have more efficient ways of moving people, like public transportation, but it's going to be more expensive to build a lot of public transit, and it's going to take some time. So that's why this is in the second level of difficulty. We've got to do it and change our habits and our expectations about mobility. Well, what about all the stuff that we ship around the world. We could add kite sails to container ships, and they do make the ships much more energy efficient, but they don't do away with the need for fuel oil altogether. Okay, so really, if we're going to do away with fuel oil altogether and go to sailing ships, we're really talking about reducing the scale of global trade quite dramatically. That's why this is not in level one. We're starting to get into harder stuff. And how about our buildings? Okay, slapping an air source heat pump onto the side of a building is a good idea, but that's not enough either. We're going to have to redesign and retrofit millions of houses and public spaces across this country to make them much, much more energy efficient. Now, there are ways of doing this. In Germany, there's what's called the passive house movement. And it's actually using technology and principles developed here in the United States back in the 1970s during, you know, the energy crises of many years ago. But basically, this is using daylighting and super insulation and heat sinks and so on to reduce the energy usage in a typical building by about 90 to 95%. So why don't we make all of our building regulations require passive house standards? This is starting to be done in Europe. Not so much here in the U.S. so far. There are 20,000 passive house buildings that have been constructed in Germany. Here in the United States, more like 20. So that's level two. And if we do all the stuff in level two, we might be able to get to like 80% reduction in reliance on fossil fuels. So now we're down to the really hard stuff. How about building construction? What do we use for building construction? A lot of steel and concrete. Well, it turns out that steel and concrete are really fossil fuel intensive. Making cement, we do it in giant kilns that are heated to about 1,500 degrees centigrade. And we do that with fossil fuels. Now, in principle, it would be possible to produce that kind of industrial high heat using hydrogen or electricity. But it would probably be a lot more expensive, and we would have to completely redesign the process. Nobody's doing that right now. We could be making rubber with tree sap again, rather than using oil for synthetic rubber. But how much tree sap do we have? And, you know, how much would it cost to do that? So we have to look probably at reducing the total material throughput of the economy, you know, the amount of cement and steel and mined materials that we're using. A lot of manufacturing is done with electricity, so that's good. We've already got that electrified. But the materials that we use in manufacturing very often come from mining, and those mined materials are very often shipped very long distances. All of that is dependent on fossil fuels. Now, again, we could imagine these giant mining machines running on solar or wind electricity, probably not with batteries, because batteries just don't have the energy density. But, you know, we could have electric cables running to these machines. It's possible to do. But again, nobody's doing it now, and it's likely to be more expensive, and it will be very difficult to do this on the scale that we're currently doing it. And then what about the materials that we use that are made from fossil fuels? All the petrochemicals and plastics that make their way into, you know, everything from clothing to containers to communications devices. So extracting all of those materials or finding renewable substitutes, we have a lot of work to do. We're talking about a world of smaller scale in terms of production and consumption, probably more labor in many production processes. We're talking about much more recycled natural materials, reusing and repairing things rather than throwing them away. Essentially, what this looks like is a completely new economic model. Over the last century or so, we've gotten used to the economic model called consumerism. And this started back in the 1920s and 30s and 50s, really. We had then the problem of overproduction. With cheap fossil fuels, we could make stuff faster than people were accustomed to buying it. So the solution to that was to talk people into buying more stuff than they thought they needed. So we invented an advertising industry to do that, and consumer credit industry, loaning people money so they could afford to buy stuff that they couldn't buy. We created a consumer economy characterized by planned obsolescence. The whole idea was to get everybody to buy as much stuff as they could. Well, we're moving into something that's almost entirely the opposite, a conserver economy, where the incentive will have to be somehow, one way or another, to get people to reuse, recycle, and remanufacture stuff. Now, how do we do that financially, economically, in terms of jobs and so on? This is to be determined, but it's going to be a big deal. This will be the economic transformation of the remainder of our lifetime. Now, when David Fridley and I looked at the communications sector, we found this is definitely level three. A lot of the assembly processes, again, use electricity, no problem. You can power those with solar, wind, or whatever your source of electricity, no problem. But the high heat processes for producing the materials and the sources of the materials themselves are a big problem. Whereas now we buy a new iPhone every year or 18 months, that's not how it's going to work in the future. If we want to maintain something like an internet and cloud and cell phones and all of this kind of electronic infrastructure, we're going to have to do it in a way that is probably on a smaller scale, that looks a lot more like what the internet looks like in much poorer countries. Imagine getting a smartphone and expecting it to last for 10 or 20 years. That's the future. And then there are some things that just don't work in the renewable future, and aviation is in that category. Yes, we probably could have airplanes that run on sophisticated biofuels or on cryogenic hydrogen, but in the case of hydrogen, it would require a complete redesign of all aircraft. In the case of biofuels, we're talking about fuels that have an inherent high cost from both a dollar and an energy perspective. It will take more energy to produce these fuels than they will give us when we burn them. So we'll be having to subsidize the production of those biofuels from other energy sources, which means they're inherently very expensive. So we could have vestiges of air travel with, you know, helium blimps or, you know, a few airliners running on hydrogen or biofuels, but it's not going to look anything like the aviation industry, commercial aviation industry that we see today. And you can get some idea of where we're headed just in terms of the relative energy efficiency of different transport modes. You know, rail turns out to be very efficient in terms of moving tons per mile. We actually need to rebuild our rail networks in this country and rely much less on trucking. Now, when we get to the point of fully transitioning our food system to where it's entirely localized and organic, if we do this intelligently, there could actually be some side benefits, because it's possible to use permaculture and organic production in ways that build topsoil. Now, we've been mining topsoil using industrial agriculture, and that's actually been a very large net contributor to greenhouse gases. But if we begin building topsoil, what we're doing in the process is actually capturing and storing carbon from the atmosphere back into the soil. And so there could be a net benefit from a climate standpoint to this energy transition. And at the end of the day, when we've finished doing the level three really hard stuff, we could be in a situation where not only are we no longer adding CO2 to the atmosphere, but we're actually reducing the carbon load. Now, how much energy are we likely to have at the end of this process? That's an unknown. Again, there are too many variables, but most of the variables that David and I have looked at are ones that seem to militate in the direction of less usable energy. The question that a lot of people are asking is, could renewable energy enable us to maintain our current lifestyle? Well, as the Global Footprint Network has documented, our current lifestyle entails using the world's resources at about four times the sustainable rate. I'm talking about how we live in North America. So asking if we can maintain a North American lifestyle with renewable energy is basically asking, can we use renewable energy to continue living unsustainably? And the answer to that question is, well, not for very long. So we should be aiming for a much lower energy consumption level anyway. And if we aim for a lower level, we're much more likely to be able to meet that level of demand with intermittent sources like solar and wind that are backed up by other renewable sources like hydropower, geothermal, and the rest, which can be used as baseload, right? If we're demanding current level of energy consumption, then we create all kinds of engineering problems in terms of buffering that intermittency with storage and grid upgrades and source redundancy and so on. But you can get rid of most of those engineering nightmares just by reducing energy demand pretty dramatically, like 70 to 90%, because then you can rely on these other sources, again, like hydro, geothermal, and so on, for baseload, and then use solar and wind for electricity that you can use when it's available. And you can schedule and time your energy consumption according to electricity availability. So that's the cheapest way of engineering the energy transition. So this is what our energy future is likely to look like. Less overall energy. Much of it will be less controllable. We will be less mobile altogether. We're not going to have aviation, and other forms of mobility will be constrained. And therefore, our economies are going to have to be much more localized. Altogether, we're not talking about a plug-and-play transition where we unplug the coal power plant, plug in a solar panel, and continue living exactly the way we're accustomed to. We're talking about a civilization reboot. As we do this, we're going to have to think about energy equity also, because all of this is going to cost a lot. So how do we pursue it? Do we just let those folks who can afford to have solar panels and wind turbines install their own energy systems, and the rest of us just rely on what we can still afford until it runs out or it's no longer available? That's one possible pathway to a renewable energy future. It will be an extremely dysfunctional pathway because all it will do is exacerbate the already extreme economic inequality that we see in this country and around the world. So if we don't want that future, we're going to have to plan for energy equity. And that's another whole lecture. So the opportunities here are sizable. We could have a much more energy-efficient economy. We could have, in fact, a more acceptable quality of life, even with much lower energy consumption per capita, if we plan for the transition and make it in a coordinated way. Obviously, we'll have a much more stable climate if we do this. Obviously, we'll have greatly reduced health and environmental impacts and costs, and we will be able to remove carbon from the atmosphere. But it's going to require a lot of investment. That means we have to make this a top priority as a society. It will require regulation. I said earlier, we have to basically regulate coal out of existence, and then do that also with oil and natural gas. And we can't do that until we have alternatives ready to go. We're going to have to change behaviors and expectations, and it's going to ultimately give us an economy that looks very different from the consumer economy of the 20th century. So it's a big job. And right now, we don't have folks at the national political level talking very much about it. In fact, we have one whole party that denies that this is even a possibility or a necessity. So we have a lot of work on our hands. And where we can do this work on the local level, we can get started. And therefore, our economies are going to have to be much more localized. This is going to be a difficult, expensive, and long process. We can't do it all in 5 or 10 years. But we have to get started, and the longer we wait, the more difficult and expensive the process, and the more likely we will end up at the end of the day with a political and economic system that's much less functional than it would otherwise be.
That was Richard Heinberg. He's senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and has written extensively on energy and ecological issues. Even his first book, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, caught the attention and imagination of many. He has been quoted and interviewed by Reuters, AP, and Time magazine, and on TV in the US, Canada, Australia, and by Al Jazeera. Heinberg has also appeared in many films and TV documentaries, including Leonardo DiCaprio's 11th Hour. His animations, Don't Worry, Drive On, Who Killed Economic Growth, and 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Minutes, have been viewed by more than 1.6 million people on YouTube. He was recorded and filmed by TUC Radio at the Little Lake Grange in the small former logging town of Willits, California, on November 15, 2015. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Those of us in the first world who live relatively comfortable lives, at some level we know that the material comfort with which we live is built on the backs of people primarily in the global south, in the third world. And we know that's inconsistent with our own moral principles. We know it violates our concern for the fundamental dignity of all people and for equality.
That's the voice of Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Robert Jensen about his book, All My Bones Shake, and society's four fundamentalisms that we need to deal with to move forward in a healthy way. So stay tuned.
We are privileged to have as our guest Dr. Robert Jensen. He teaches media law, ethics, and politics at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Get Enough, The Heart of Whiteness, Citizen of the Empire, and Right in Dissent. His latest book is All My Bones Shake. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Jensen.
Great to be with you, Sylvia.
At the root of the current political economy and ecological chaos is a national religious unrest that is thwarting our self-awareness and slowing our spiritual progress to a glacial crawl. This is a quote from the cover on your book. In our society, we seem to think of religion as the belief in some type of deity, whether that be a Christianity religion, Muslim religion, or any kind of religion. I would argue there seems to be another religion, and that is the religion of the marketplace, where we accept things as the natural result of the marketplace. And you actually covered this in your book. So for our audience, where does this come from? Where does this blind faith in the market come, and how does it manifest?
Well, of course, you're right that we talk about religion and spirituality and faith and the things that define us. But in reality, in the contemporary United States, and the truth is it's blanketed much of the world, there is a kind of market fundamentalism, an economic fundamentalism that not only claims capitalism is the best way to organize an economy, but claims it's the only way, it's the natural way. It's an attempt to make a set of human choices about how to distribute the wealth of the world as if they were natural, as if they were beyond critique. And that's a kind of core definition of fundamentalism, a belief in a set of principles with absolute certainty in a way that can't be challenged. But, of course, an economy is a set of human choices. Why do we accept this market fundamentalism? Well, part of it is simply the effort that has been put into a propaganda system by mostly a relatively small elite to get ordinary people to believe that the incredibly unequal distribution of wealth in the world is somehow unavoidable. But, of course, we know it's not. And we know that we have within our grasp, if we were to do so, ways to devise an economy that would not be perfect, that would still require a lot of struggle, but would not produce the profound inequality which now structures the world economy. I would just remind listeners that as we speak, about half the world's population, according to the World Bank, more than 3 billion people on this planet today live on less than $2.50 a day U.S. for everything, food, shelter, education, medical. That is, half the population lives in a kind of abject poverty. I would want to believe that that is not our only option, that there are other ways to devise an economy. And I think, paradoxically, although in this country many people who identify as Christians also accept this market fundamentalism, I think Christianity is a source of resistance to this fundamentalism. And in the progressive fashioning of an understanding of Christianity, I think there is a lot of hope.
One of the things you address in your book is you say there are four fundamentalisms. So I wonder, you talked about the market fundamentalism and how we see this invisible hand sort of fixing everything and the market dictating the choices. So it implies that citizens have choices. So perhaps we should start by addressing the issue of choice then, because if you are a Haitian, your choices are very different than if you are a worker in Canada or the U.S. So how is this constructed and maintained, this myth of equality and democracy in our society?
Well, of course, first of all, we should recognize that within the contemporary corporate capitalist system, it's not a complete myth. There is some freedom to choose, and there is some movement from people who begin in low socioeconomic places and rise up. That is, there is a kernel of truth to the notion in capitalism that anybody can make it. Certainly there are people who were raised poor who became wealthy. Certainly there is some level of choice in the system. But the question is, does everyone have meaningful choices with the kind of equality that makes it possible to truly choose? And the answer there is, of course, no, because capitalism has been and always will be, from my point of view, a wealth-concentrating system. And kind of the lie of capitalism is the idea that everybody can make it. But, of course, the system is premised on not everyone making it. And when we look across time and space, we see that historically that relatively small elite, which has for the most part been concentrated in the first world, in Europe, the United States, Japan, a few other places, has used its power. It's used force, violence, coercion. It's used all of that to maintain that inequality. Well, I think when you step back and look at the whole system, one sees that capitalism is, in fact, inconsistent with democracy, because the way capitalism concentrates wealth leads to a concentration of political power. One can see that capitalism is inconsistent with our own principles and values about what it means to be a human being, a belief in the dignity of all people, a belief in equality. And for those reasons, I think capitalism is fundamentally incompatible with Christianity. I think to take seriously the text and the tradition of the Christian faith is to be anti-capitalist. And in fact, if one looks back at the early Christians in the first two or three centuries after Christ was killed, you see that many people in that era believed that to be a Christian was to live communally, to share, to renounce private property. Well, that's not capitalism, in case anybody isn't clear. All right, so the Christian tradition itself is rooted in a rejection of the inequality and materialism that defines capitalism. I think the principles of Christianity, when appropriately understood today, would lead to a rejection of the current capitalist system. And that's why in the book I try to root myself in that Christian tradition, which is the tradition of the culture I come out of. And I think the struggle to define what that Christianity means is very important.
You brought two very important points, and I think that's how religious has been sort of thwarted to be in favor of capital and economic fundamental principles. And I just want to point out that I recently interviewed Bruce Gagnon. He pointed out that, you know, with the election of President Obama, everyone was celebrating a shift and change. And yet, he says, you know, in 1 year, President Obama has done what no other Republican has ever done in the history of the U.S. And he turned $12.3 trillion in bailouts. Nine out of every $10 was given to the banks. And I'm reminded of the story in the Bible where Jesus spoke against this. And this idea that we accept certain policies blindly, I think, needs to be addressed. I'm trying to reconcile the fact that we take this as a, you know, without challenging. On one hand, we say the bailouts needed to be given. Why? Who profits in an economic crisis? Who's profiting out of the massive military budgets that are being issued? So it seems to me there's a structure behind this. Can you speak to this?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Of course, in times of crisis, there is always a push on the part of elites to define the crisis as unmanageable without immediate action from the top. And, of course, sometimes that's true. If your country is being invaded by another country, perhaps that might be true. But with an economic crisis like the one we just lived through, or are still living through, there was another option, and that option was to rethink the fundamental nature of the system, to use the crisis not simply to shore up and reinforce the inequality in the existing system, but to ask, is this a moment where we can devise something new? And that can happen with the input of everyone. There could have just as easily been a process when the subprime mortgage crisis hit to convene a kind of national conversation about what we want in an economy. And I think that the reason that didn't happen was not because it was impossible, but because people with power didn't want it to happen. And I think the tension around this is mounting. Ordinary people increasingly, even people who 5-10 years ago would have endorsed the capitalist system in the United States on the assumption that it would provide for them, are now seeing that the people who run that capitalist system really don't care about ordinary people, and that ordinary people are starting to push back and to recognize their real fate in that system. Now, I think the really important moment for those of us who consider ourselves politically active or organizers or community activists is, can we marshal that resentment into positive channels to challenge the system? You know, Barack Obama happens to be the guy running things at the moment, but it's not the guy running things at the moment in Washington who really holds power. It's the people who control the productive capacity of the country, the capitalists in that sense, the owners and the high-level managers. And we have to challenge them. And then eventually, if we're successful, we give the Barack Obamas of the world a choice. You either sink your fate in with the people, or you ally yourself with the wealthy and the privileged, and it's a choice then politicians have to make. You know, all of this is a long-term struggle that's been going on for decades, centuries, in which ordinary people have been trying to take control of our own lives. And this is a moment where I think there are things possible precisely because of the crisis.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the fundamentalism, this fundamentalism that you speak of in your book, of the state, this nationalism that promotes or sometimes blinds people to the actions of their government. How does this unfold? And you know, because it seems every empire has always justified whatever crimes they commit as being in the interest of the people, this sort of benevolent empire. How does it manifest, and why should we be aware of it and fight against it?
I think you're, again, hitting on an incredibly important subject, especially here in the United States, which is kind of the empire of the modern world at this point. You know, as you point out, most imperial powers in the past, whether it was Britain, France, you know, for a brief time Germany, Russia, they often justified their crimes around the world, the crimes that exploited the resources of other places and oppressed the people of those places. They justified those crimes as somehow being in the interests of advancing civilization, of civilizing the natives. These are very, you know, obvious justifications and failed justifications. Of course, no serious person would believe them today. Yet here in the United States, we have our own imperial justifications, mostly around the idea of bringing democracy to other parts of the world. Well, we have to break down that fundamentalism, that sort of unthinking acceptance of a set of principles that really don't conform to reality. Does the United States bring democracy to the world? Well, I think we can look across the board, especially in the post-World War II era, at U.S. interventions, and see that, in fact, the United States has done more to thwart democracy in other parts of the world than to advance it. So just as we have to break down the notion that markets and capitalism are inevitable, that fundamentalism must be challenged, so must the fundamentalism around the special role of the United States, the idea that the United States, by definition, is always doing good in the world. Well, a lot of people in the United States hold on to that fundamentalist notion as well. And I think all we're saying is that, you know, reality does not conform to fundamentalist notions. Reality is complex. Reality has a historical base that we have to try to understand. Reality includes an honest accounting of power, privilege, and oppression. And when we do that, of course, the fundamentalism melts away, just as I think it does in the religious arena, that when you fully understand the complexity of the human experience, it's hard to hold on to fundamentalisms. And that's what we have to do, is kind of ruthlessly tell the truth about this country, this economy, and our place in the world.
Your book also talks about the technological fundamentalism, and I want to address this because we are living in an era of particularly in Latin America, of incredible aggression. We see the coup in Honduras taking place, and the world has stood up and denounced the coup. And in many cases, we defend these policies as this developmental idea. And technology sort of goes hand in hand. But I think technology in the interest of whom? And technology for whom? So what do you mean by the technological fundamentalism? How do you see it being counterintuitive to a society that is inclusive and pluralistic?
I think here the critique and concern about a kind of high-energy, high-technology life is rapidly spreading. The one thing we know without question is that the fundamental health of the ecosystem that makes our own lives possible is in dramatic decline, and that decline is overwhelmingly because of human intervention into the ecosystem in ways that are not sustainable. It's the way we farm. It's the way we extract materials from the world. It's the way we dump toxins back into that world. Everyone understands, at least everyone who's willing to tell the truth, that we have created a system based on the high energy potential of coal, oil, and natural gas, and the technological advances that have come with that, that we based a system on an unsustainable relationship to the earth. Now, what I call, and others have called, technological fundamentalism is really the belief that whatever problems have come from that high-energy, high-technology world can be fixed with simply more high-energy, high-technology. And you see this over and over again. We talk about the energy problem, and there is a scrambling to believe that we can invent new ways of creating as much energy as coal, oil, and natural gas have provided, even though that's an extremely contentious claim. We see the problems created, such as global warming, you know, the loss of the ozone layer, all these things. And instead of asking a fundamental question, which is, should human beings adjust the way we interact in the world, lower our expectations for energy use and consumption, to try and bring our way of living back into some sort of balance with the larger world? That question is never really considered, and all that we talk about in the dominant culture is how to find new high-energy, high-technology solutions to the problems that high-energy, high-technology has created. And that may end up being the most dangerous fundamentalism. I think, you know, religious fundamentalism is dangerous. We see the negative consequences when people have an unthinking belief in the absolute righteousness of a religious system. We talked about the problems of market fundamentalism, of national fundamentalism. But with technological fundamentalism, unfortunately, we're not just talking about the inequality within the human family. We're talking about whether the human family can continue to live in any sustainable way on this planet. And so many of us are concerned that this reflexive technological fundamentalism, this belief that technology will always save us, whether that might end up being the most dangerous fundamentalism of them all.
I think in society we tend to be selective as to what we consider to be important. And one of the ways militarism has been able to advance is by creating this fear of the other in society. And who are the other? Those who we do not recognize being equal to us or similar to us, whether that be skin or language or, you know, whatever we define as different. What do we lose when we ignore inequity, injustice, in the pursuit of our goals for development or an improved quality of life? What do we lose in the long run?
Well, I think the answer is quite simple. We lose our own humanity. Those of us in the first world who live relatively comfortable lives, at some level we know that the material comfort with which we live is built on the backs of people primarily in the global south, in the third world. And we know that's inconsistent with our own moral principles. We know it violates our concern for the fundamental dignity of all people and for equality. Yet the material comfort with which we live often allows us to ignore that. But I think when we do ignore that, in a very basic way, we lose some of our own humanity. And here, I think, is a place where traditional religion actually can help. Because if you think about whether it's Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, all of them are, at their core, I believe, are a call to recognize the universal nature of the human family. That is, all of them include principles that remind us that the value of my life, sitting here in the United States today is of no greater or lesser value than the lives of people across the world. That person who might be living in sub-Saharan Africa on less than $2.50 a day, that person has the same moral value as I do, that person's child has the same moral value as my child. That is the universalizing call of religion, and it's clearly at the core of the Christian faith. Now, the problem, of course, is that religion can also be a way in which we distance ourselves from other human beings. That is, religion, although I think it is a call to the universal, also often leads people to draw the artificial boundaries you're talking about. Well, there's me and my group, the good Christians, and then there's all the sinners out in the world. And you can see how religion is, from my point of view, perverted to create barriers instead of break down those barriers. But again, I think that's why, for those of us who have an interest in struggling over the definition of Christianity and other faith traditions, we have a lot of work we can do not to invent a new religion, but simply to say it's time in the prophetic sense, that it's time to honor the true values of the religion, to honor that universal conception of the human family. All of that's within our grasp. There's a tradition, there's a text, there's a space that we call church where we can come together and do this. And I think that's, for me at least, the animating spirit behind my own interest in religion.
You, in your book, talk about power over in a dead world. What do you mean by power over, and what are the alternatives?
When we think about the question of power, in conventional terms, power is defined as the ability to make people do what they would otherwise not do. I have power over you, Sylvia, if I can make you do things you would otherwise not do. And that's what we tend to call power over. And of course, power over is real. It operates in the world. It often has disastrous consequences. But we can also think about power as power with. That is, my power is not over you, it's with you. It's in the collaborative, creative possibilities of you and I combining forces. And that's a different sense of power. That's the power, I think, that makes it possible to imagine a decent future. The power over, I believe, can lead only to a dead world. And I would make the argument right now that in the United States, given the values of this national fundamentalism and the market fundamentalism, often connected to a very reactionary religious fundamentalism, I would describe that as a dead culture, a culture that has no capacity to generate creativity and to generate life. All it can do is extract from others, which leads to death. So I know it sounds rather perhaps dramatic, but I really do think in many profound ways in the contemporary United States, we live in a dead culture, a culture that hangs on to ideas that are no longer consistent with reality, that hangs on to systems that are not consistent with a decent future. And I think we have to create something new. My own view is that that's not likely to happen in Washington, D.C. or on Wall Street in the centers of power. It's going to happen at the margins in places like Austin, Texas, where I live, where, you know, as we speak, we're working to acquire a building for a new community center. We're working to create some worker-owned cooperatives where people can control their own economic life. We're talking about resisting, you know, racism and sexism. We're talking about coming together in this sense of power with, not to control each other, but to try and find ways to create something new. And that's where I think the real hope for the future lies.
What do we need to create this new society that you describe?
Well, I think we need a 12-pack of beer and some barbecue. No, I'm kidding. That's the solution to everything in Texas. Just get a 12-pack of beer and some barbecue and everything will be fine. What does it take? Well, I think it takes, first of all, a kind of honesty to confront the very dire circumstances we find ourselves in. And beyond that, I think it takes a sense of hope. And by hope, I don't mean unrealistic, overly optimistic assessments. I think you know, people have used the term a kind of stubborn hope, a hope that won't give up even when things are looking bleak. And I think we should tell the truth. Things do look pretty bleak in this country at the moment. Much of the population is in the grips of these fundamentalisms. Yet I think that we rescue our own humanity, especially those of us with privilege, and I have a lot of privilege. I'm white, I'm male, I'm professionally educated and employed. You know, the way I'm going to save my own humanity is not by holding on to my privilege or holding on to my resources. It's going to be coming into spaces where I willingly give up those resources in a collaboration with others. That's how we save ourselves. You know, sometimes people look at the political work I do and they think somehow I'm this very noble person. And the fact is, I'm probably the most selfish human being I know. I do this work because I want to, in a sense, save my own life. I want to create or help create a world in which I can be fully human. And the world we live in right now does not allow that. The world we live in closes off so many avenues for us to express our own humanity. It keeps us trapped in the corporate world. It keeps us trapped in conventional politics. It keeps us trapped in a commodified commercial culture that is always telling us to buy, buy, buy.
I was speaking to a journalist from Honduras. Gerardo Torres is a young man who started a movement called Los Necios, the stubborn. And they speak precisely what you're talking about, this stubborn hope, this idea that although you are constantly told you don't have a right to have those dreams, he says we're going to have them and we're going to define those who tell us we do not have the right to pursue a society with dignity and, you know, just a decent quality of life. What inspires you? What inspires your work to continue to struggle?
Well, I can tell you that's very easy. What inspires me is the people like you just described. Here in Austin, I've been incredibly fortunate to work with people, often younger people, people from what we call traditionally minority communities, people from parts of society that are not as wealthy, and I watch them struggle against much greater obstacles than I face myself. And I see them struggling and struggling joyously. You know, as someone who's older and more established and materially in a much more comfortable position, what I've discovered is when I go to those people and say, I want to join you in your struggle. I want to commit my own time and resources to the projects that you have going, that, as I said, I benefit tremendously. This is what gives my own life meaning. It's what deepens my own sense of my own humanity. There's inspiration every time we turn the corner. We just have to be willing to see it.
Thank you so much for joining us. For people who want to read your book, All My Bones Shake is an amazing book. It really challenges to look at our values and our own beliefs and how they contribute or perpetuate a system of injustice and what can we do about it. So how can people access your book?
Well, the easiest way to find me, if you have access to a computer, is just to Google my name, Robert Jensen, and the first page that comes up will be mine.
Thank you again for joining us.
Great to be with you, Sylvia. Thanks.
Take care.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.